I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for yourself for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com, and you'll see the link to becoming a Patreon member in the upper right-hand corner of that website. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we do not have any guests, but I am going to read a recap of the Mr. Olympia from 40 years ago, the 1984 Mr. Olympia, which turned out to be one of the best Mr. Olympias in the contest's almost 60-year history. This was the contest that Lee Haney won his first Mr. Olympia. It was held at the Felt Forum in Madison Square Garden in New York, and it was a huge contest, and it also included the return of Sergio Oliva to the IFBB. Sergio was, of course, a three-time Mr. Olympia winner, and Sergio had a falling out with the IFBB after 1973, and he never competed again for over 10 years in that organization. And then Wayne D'Amelio, who was the promoter of the contest, talked Sergio into competing, and Sergio made his much-celebrated comeback. Of course, he was past his prime at that time and not quite the Sergio that we knew and loved from when he won the Olympia or battled Arnold, but it was still great seeing Sergio back. And it was really a unique contest because this was the one Olympia, I think, that featured a lot of the old-time bodybuilders, the guys from the 70s, along with the new guys coming up from the 80s. So it was really an interesting blend of bodybuilders that competed. They had a lot of competitors, and a lot of the guys were in really, really great shape. So I thought it would be fun to go back and look at the contest reports of this really historic Mr. Olympia contest. And I've got four different contest reports from four of the major magazines at the time. Of course, Muscle and Fitness magazine and Flex magazine, which was the Joe Weider magazines. They had a big report on it. Rick Wayne wrote the one for Flex, and Jeff Everson wrote the one for Muscle and Fitness. And then Muscle Mag International, another really big magazine at the time. Greg Zulak was their top writer, and he wrote the contest report. And then Perry Rader's Ironman magazine, which was not yet sold to John Bailick. So this was the original Perry Rader Ironman, and that report was written by Gary Bartlett. So we got four different reports here of the Mr. Olympia coming up today on the podcast. All right, I am still working on getting some guests. Frank Richard, I got his number on WhatsApp because he is out in England. So I've been in contact with Frank. I just have to find a date when he can do the interview. That will be a great interview. I can't wait for that. Still talking to Phil Hill, the 1987 heavyweight nationals champ and then the 1988 Night of the Champions winner. Phil is interested in talking, but again, we just have to set a date. Tim Belknap, the 1981 Mr. Olympia winner, just an absolute freak of his time. One of the most incredible bodybuilders of the early 1980s. I have been in contact with Tim, but again, he's very, very busy. So we have not been able to secure a time to talk. Rick Wayne, I'm still bugging him every week. It's just a matter of when Rick wants to do it. It's already been a year and a half since we talked to Rick, if you can believe that. I can't believe it's been over a year. That's amazing. And Bill St. John, who was a really top AAU competitor in the Mr. America contest in the early 1970s. I believe he took third place when Casey Viator won it in 1971 because Pete Kromkowski was second and Bill was third, and Bill also won the Best Abs Award at the Mr. America several times. So Bill is still around, and I've been in contact with him, so we just have to figure out how to get him connected to Zoom so we can do the interview. But I got all these guys I'm working on, so one day I'm going to surprise you guys with an actual interview because I know we've been short on interviews for a long time here on the podcast. Speaking of podcasts, Lee Haney was on a podcast. Ron Harris, who used to work for Muscular Development, and since they have now since closed shop, they've closed down the magazine, and I believe they also closed down their website. So Ron, who worked diligently for Steve Blackman for Muscular Development Magazine for many, many, many years, wrote tons and tons of articles, well-respected in the industry for all his hard work. He is now kind of out of a job, and he started his own YouTube channel, the Ron Harris YouTube channel on YouTube, and he has been coming up with some different topics. He's got some pretty interesting videos, and he interviewed Lee Haney because Lee made a statement a couple weeks ago about the look of today's bodybuilders, how they don't have the symmetry and shape that they had back in the day, and they're not beautiful physiques anymore. And he got a lot of controversy over that. A lot of people agreed with him. A lot of people didn't agree with him. A lot of people say he's old school. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Other people totally agreed with what Lee said and believe that the modern day bodybuilding has kind of lost its way. And the more popular look is the classic physiques right now. So anyways, Ron had Lee on and they talked about it. So I have a newsletter that I give to all my Patreon members. Anybody who subscribes as a Patreon member, they get a newsletter every month. Try to put it out at least once a month or maybe a little bit more than that. And Lee did a big interview with Ron. So I talked about that on my newsletter. And I also included the link to that. So check that out on YouTube if you get a chance. Very, very interesting discussion from Lee Haney. All right. And I did get a couple emails. If you guys are interested in emailing me, asking me any questions or any suggestions for the show, please do so. My email is naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I did get a couple emails since we were last on a couple weeks ago. This one says, "Hey, John, I love the podcast. I just wanted to tell you that I love the bodybuilding article episodes just as much as the interviews." All right. "It's always fun to catch up with the legends, but it's as fun to hear some deep cuts from hard-to-find bodybuilding magazines from the golden age. I appreciate all of your hard work coordinating the episodes with guests and finding some great articles to read for us. I can't wait to hear more. Thanks, John. Vincent Van Gool." All right. Thank you, Vincent. I appreciate that. Appreciate your support. And then Andrew Hefferman, who is one of our big Patreon supporters. Andrew supports the podcast every month with his donation, so I appreciate Andrew. And when I sent out our newsletter yesterday about the Lee Haney interview, Andrew said, "Great newsletter, John. Interesting that two of the articles cite Ferrigno as the heir apparent to the Mr. O, one of them even claiming that Lou would catch him within a year. We can add Lou's decision to accept the role as the Hulk to the list of great if-onlys in golden era bodybuilding. If only Arnold hadn't competed in 1980, if only Franco hadn't competed in 1981, and if only Lou had stayed out of show business." Yeah, when I do my newsletters every month, I always go back and I include a magazine that was published like 40 or 50 years ago from that same month and year. So I go back, like, I think I went back 50 years and I put in an article from, or not an article, but I highlighted one of Iron Man magazines from 1974. And they covered the IFBB Mr. America contest in that magazine. And they were talking about Lou Ferrigno, because he won the 1973 IFBB Mr. America that year. And that's what Andrew's talking about. In that article, they talked about Lou as an heir apparent to the Mr. Olympia. And I think they also had one of those physique review articles by Franklin Page. Franklin was a frequent writer for Iron Man back in the day in the 70s. And every year, he would do his physique review for the year, which was pretty cool to read. He would go through all the previous year and talk about the physiques that really impressed him, whether there were people that won contests or guys that were just in the contest and had showed a lot of potential. So I think those were the two articles that Andrew was talking about. But thank you guys for your emails. And as I said, if anybody else wants to email me, just do so at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, so let's dive into these articles. These are we got four big articles to read, so this should take a little bit of a time. So let's start with Muscle Mag. And this was the March 1985 issue of Muscle Mag International. It is written by Greg Zulak, and it includes photography by Bob Kennedy, Steve Douglas, and Gary Bartlett. And Gary also wrote the article for Iron Man. So it says, IFBB Mr. Olympia, November 3rd and 4th, 1984, Felt Forum, Madison Square Gardens, New York. The 1984 Mr. Olympia contest returned to New York, its origin and birthplace after an absence of 10 years, and before an enthusiastic capacity crowd at Madison Square Garden's Felt Forum, a tremendously improved Lee Haney, looking totally awesome, was crowned the new Mr. Olympia. Mohamed Makawe, the magic Egyptian, once again, for the second year in a row, had to be satisfied with second place. Makawe was as near perfect as a bodybuilder can be, but it was simply a case of a good big man beating a good little man. In a strong third place was the mighty German Josip Wilkosch in his all-time best shape. And if Haney hadn't shown up in such incredible shape, many felt Josip might have been lugging the Mr. Olympia trophy back to Germany right now. The show had about everything you'd expect of a Mr. Olympia contest, which ran the whole gamut of human emotion. Tremendous excitement, eager anticipation, comedy, and even a little pathos, sadness, and disappointment, too. And of course, even though huge, thick, defined muscle to satisfy any hardcore muscle aficionado. Before the contest, the rumors were flying thick and fast. Boyer Coe, Roy Callender, Chris Dickerson, Robbie Robinson, and Bill Grant were all reportedly entering the Olympia once again. Tony Pearson was also supposed to have been given special permission to compete. The thought of all these great former champs returning to compete was thrilling. New York's Olympia was setting up to be the best ever. There was great excitement over the fact that the Golden Eagle, Mr. Legs himself, Tom Platz, was returning to compete too. And I had it on good authority that Tom was looking absolutely awesome. I heard too from writer Bob Gallup, who had been up to California the week before, that Samir Banoot was in tremendous shape and ready to defend his title. I had myself seen Mohamed Makawe guest pose only 7 days before the Olympia, and I knew he was ripped and ready. Also, everyone wanted to know if Mike Christian, recent American and world amateur heavyweight champion, would compete. But the biggest excitement was caused by the rumored return of the one and only myth, Sergio Oliva, after a 12-year absence from Olympia competition. From speaking with Sergio a few times over the course of the past year, I knew it was no rumor. The question was, could Sergio get into top shape again and compete against the likes of Banoot, Makawe, Beckles, and Haney? In New York, where mass and size are king, many were beside themselves to find out. I know I could hardly wait to see the big man on stage. Everyone I spoke with agreed, if Sergio showed up like he did in Essen, Germany in 1972, where he scared the bejesus out of Arnold Schwarzenegger, everyone may as well compete for second place, for there'd be no doubt who the winner would be. There were some disappointments before the show, too. Frank Zane, Casey Viator, Greg DeFerro, and Bertel Fox were all forced to cancel out. I heard that DeFerro had come down with an unfortunate illness, and Fox had a back injury. Frank Zane's injured shoulder prevented him from training as he wanted, so he acted as commentator for NBC TV instead. Frank came on stage and said not to count him out yet, and he may return to competition in Belgium next year. I never did find out why Viator didn't show up. It's too bad because I heard he had been training very hard in Tucson, and he would have made a great addition to the show. For some reason, Danny Padilla was a no-show, too. Even with Zane, Viator, Padilla, Fox, and DeFerro out, there were still 20 top competitors in the show, the largest Mr. Olympia ever held. There was actually some talk about eliminating the five lowest-placing competitors after the prejudging from posing at the evening show, but this idea was dropped, much to the relief of many of the competitors. The evening before the competition, the judges' meeting was held to give the competitors a chance to air any complaints or grievances beforehand. As I entered the room, it was like I'd gone to muscle heaven. I was confronted by more muscle than most people see in a lifetime. Banoot, Wilkosch, Dickerson, Platz, Grant, Pearson, Robbie, Chuck Williams, Charles Glass, Bob Birdsong, and others all sat near the front. In the very last row sat Boyer Coe, and beside him, the myth, looking as he told me he would on the phone a few weeks ago, big, black, and ripped. I made my way to the back, and I shook Sergio's hand, hoping he'd remember me from my short stay in Chicago when I'd done some articles on him. "Hey, how's it going?" I said as I vigorously shook my hand. "Hey, good to see you," answered Sergio. And then, as if to ready my mind, he said, "Oh, man, I'm ready." Boyer Coe, upon hearing this, grimaced and a worried look crossed his face. We spoke a bit more, and then IFBB President Ben Weider called for a meeting to start. Ben gave a speech in which he emphasized to all the competitors that the IFBB has done everything possible to ensure a fair decision tomorrow, and that at great expense, the very best judges have been brought in to judge. And since there's only one judge from each of seven different countries, it's impossible to fix the contest. And also, there was to be two alternate judges and a scrutineer. If any judge or judges showed obvious bias and or incompetence after the first round of the prejudging, they would be replaced by one of the alternate judges. Although this speech was for all the bodybuilders in general, I think it was aimed specifically at Sergio. Everyone knew of Sergio's past problems with the Weiders, and Ben wanted the air clear before the contest. When Ben asked if the competitors were satisfied with the judges or were there any complaints, of course, no one spoke up. To complain would single out a competitor for possible retribution from the judge accused of being biased or incompetent, and no one wanted to risk that. Ben Weider also announced that each competitor from first to last would receive a small medallion, and for the first time, the first three would receive large, and I mean large, additional medallions, as in the Olympic tradition. Gold for first, silver for second, and bronze for third. All during the meeting, the Weider photographers, Mike Neveu and Bill Dobbins, were shooting photos of the various bodybuilders, as was Gary Bartlett, who at this contest was doing photos not only for Muscle Mag, but for Ironman, Muscle Training Illustrated, and several other magazines. When Joe Weider went over to speak to Sergio, the cameras really started clicking, especially when Sergio and Joe stood up and shook hands. It seemed everyone wanted words with the myth, but because of the two-part article run by Muscle Mag International, he spent most of his time talking to Bob Kennedy and myself. I'll say this about Sergio. If you're good to him, he's good to you. At one point, Ricky Wayne came over and Sergio said to me, pointing at him, "He did some really good articles on me and he's really helped me a lot." At which point, Ricky looked at me and asked coolly, "Who are you?" I replied, "Zulak." And Ricky just said, "Oh, arrogance personified," and walked away. Finally, my curiosity got the better of me, and I had to ask Sergio to show me his chest. Lowering his sweat top to expose his massive chest, he flexed his right pec. As it bunched up, I could see all the striations and muscle fibers. Then, without asking, he raised his sweat top up and let me feel his abs. My finger went up to my knuckle, and it was as hard as a rock. He seemed ready to me, and I was especially pleased that he had tanned and was a nice dark brown, rather than his usual sallow yellow tone. He told me he weighed 240 pounds. Personally, I'd have liked to have seen him at 230 pounds or even 225 pounds, but who am I to tell Sergio Oliva what weight to compete at? The next morning, I was to spend half an hour in Sergio's suite with his wife, Arlene, and their new two-week-old baby, Sergio Jr. Up at 5:30 to carb up with some pancakes and syrup, Sergio was now restless for the prejudging to start, still 3 hours away. I briefly went over with him and what to expect at the prejudging, and he assured me he had his posing down and he was ready. There was little more for me to do but wish him luck and leave him to prepare himself for battle. As the felt forum filled up with fans, the excitement in the air was so thick you could slice it with a knife. When Wayne D'Amelio asked everyone to be seated because the contest was about to start, a tremendous roar of approval went up, and the roar only got louder when the Olympia contestants finally filed on stage, with Sergio Oliva leading the way. Cries of "Sergio, Sergio" echoed throughout the room, followed by screams of the name of every other bodybuilder by fans of their own favorite bodybuilder. Three women directly behind me screamed in unison, "Samir," at which a big grin broke out on Samir Banute's face. My eyes quickly scanned up and down the lineup, trying to pick out those bodybuilders in shape and those not. All the while, the combined throes of the crowd threatened to lift the roof off the building. Looking up and down the lineup, I noticed Makawe ripped and supremely confident, a big smile on his face, Haney and Wilkosh huge and cut, Beckles, Paris, and Birdsong all in top shape, and at my end of the stage, Samir smiling confidently and Sergio looking a bit confused and overwhelmed. There were so many competitors that Sergio was forced to stand off in the darkened corner of the stage, looking angry and frustrated. I'm sure at that point that he felt there was some kind of plot to keep him out of the judges' eyes. When the competitors came on stage, the fans rushed the stage like groupies at a rock concert. And as I left my seat, I had to fight my way through a horde of fans to get to the stage. Seeking to placate Sergio, I screamed so that I would be heard above the crowd. "Don't worry, Sergio. They'll move you in a minute. Don't worry." Fortunately, just then, big Julie Levine came onto the stage and informed Sergio and Samir that in another minute or two, all the competitors would be shifted around so that those off to the corners would be moved to center stage and vice versa. This seemed to calm Sergio, and I returned to my seat. It was quite a sight to see all those top bodybuilders, all in good shape and a few in super shape, on stage at once. One thing for sure, it would be a tough contest to judge, and I didn't envy the judges' jobs. After round one of the prejudging, I was better able to sort out in my mind who was in the fight for the top spots. I did it the way the IFBB rulebook suggests, sorting into three groups. The first group of bodybuilders who'd be in the top spots, a second group for those in the middle of the pack, and a third group for those coming in the last places. My group one consisted of the following: Lee Haney, Mohammed Mokawe, Samir Banute, Bob Birdsong, Al Beckles, Yosef Wilkosh, and Sergio Oliva, and Bob Paris. My second group consisted of Tom Platz, Roy Callender, Chris Dickerson, Tony Pearson, and Boyer Coe. My third group had Chuck Williams, Bill Grant, Charles Glass, Robbie Robinson, Hubert Metz, James Gobert, and Appy Steenbeck. After round one, I had it Haney, Wilkosh, McAway, Banute, Oliva, Beckles, but I felt that Bob Birdsong could possibly crack the top six. When the judges began calling for comparisons, the only real surprise to me was the number of times that Roy Callender was called out for comparisons. To me, Roy had come in a little heavy and smooth, and I didn't even have him in my top 10. I kept wondering what the judges saw that I didn't. Except for Big Roy, it was apparent that the judges were pretty unified as so far as the top six or seven physiques. Lee Haney, Yosef Wilkosh, Mohammed Mokawe, Al Beckles, Samir Banute, Bob Paris, and Sergio Oliva were all called out for the most comparisons. And Haney, Mokawe, Wilkosh, and Beckles were all compared against one another more than the others. It seems that at least after round one, these were the top men, according to the judges. I might add that during round one, only Sergio Oliva and Tom Platz showed any fighting spirit, and they were the only ones who did extra poses. Once, after having called up to be compared with Chris Dickerson and Tom Platz for a few compulsory poses, Sergio hit a few most muscular shots, classic arms and overhead poses, which created tremendous excitement and brought out a huge roar of approval. It was like a flashback to the 1969 Mr. Olympia. This started a chain reaction, and soon everybody on stage was hitting their best shots. It took several exciting minutes for order to be restored. I think the bodybuilders enjoyed it as much as the fans. Robbie and Platz in particular seemed to get a big kick out of this spontaneous onslaught of muscular display. During round two, I saw nothing which changed my mind or the judges' collective minds either as to who the top men were. Lee Haney, Mokawe, and Wilkosh, besides being three of the most cut and muscular physiques in the show, were also three of the most symmetrical and proportional, which round two judges. So there'd be no change in places here. I expected Dickerson, Banute, and Birdsong, and Paris and Oliva all to improve their places in this round, while Beckles, Callender, and Platz to drop a bit. Round two produced some comic relief for the judges, fans, and bodybuilders alike. Tom Platz kept posing during the relaxed round and was admonished by the head judge for doing so. Each time Tom, an angelic look on his face, "Who, me?" would point to his ear as if to say, "Sorry, I couldn't hear the pose called for because of the noise." This happened several times. Finally, Samir Banute leaned over and whispered in Platz's ear as if to tell him what pose to do, and Platz theatrically thanked him. Then a few minutes later, Samir did extra poses, and when the judge admonished him, Samir too appeared to have developed a hearing problem, and he pointed at his own ear. The crowd roared with laughter. That ended the prejudging, and everyone quickly left to return to their hotels to eat and rest and get ready for the big evening show. In the interest of space, I'll give a short description of the 20 men from last to first as they were placed by the judges. In 20th place, Appy Steenbeck from Holland. Coming in last place in a contest that would usually be deemed a disgrace, but this was an extremely tough contest. Don't forget, every contestant was either a former Mr. Universe, Mr. World, Mr. Olympia, or both. When you get 20 Mr. Universes together, someone's got to finish last, and today it was Appy. This was his first pro contest and his first Olympia, so no matter where he placed, I'm sure it was a big thrill for him just to be on stage with men like Haney, Mokawe, Oliva, and Banute. Although Appy had good color and he was very hard-looking and obviously in good shape, he was lacking in calves, thighs, arms, and overall size. His posing failed to create any excitement. What had been good enough to win the lightweight Mr. Universe title against other men of his size was clearly not enough when standing next to monsters like Oliva, Haney, and Wilkosh. Appy was the smallest man in the entire contest, and one can't help but to wonder what possesses a man like this to train and diet so hard to compete in the world's biggest contest when he realistically has no chance of doing well. I don't mean to criticize. I couldn't carry Appy's gym bag. But I think that many men have delusions of grandeur and are not really in touch with reality. 19th place, James Gobert from the USA. I find it difficult to criticize James Gobert except to again question his judgment of his training and dieting so hard and going to all the expense of preparing for the Olympia when genetically you just are not as gifted as the other men and realistically cannot expect to do well. James acted like a real pro on stage during the prejudging and evening show, even though it was only his second pro contest and second Olympia. The former Mr. Universe had excellent color and was very hard-looking and cut. It was evident that he had prepared himself well and he had done as much as his body and his genetics would humanly allow, but he lacks the size and shape to be competitive for the top spots. Also, he fails to create an impact with his posing. It wasn't a matter of Gobert being bad or out of shape. It was just a matter of a lot of the other guys being so much better. I think he's one of the most underrated physiques around. 18th place, Hubert Metz from Germany. The problem with Metz, like Gobert, was not his condition, but a problem with genetics. He just doesn't have what it takes to win or even finish in the top 10. You have to admire and respect Hubert for all the hard work put into building his physique, and he is a former Mr. Universe, but he's at the outer limits of his genetic capability. He's gone as far as he can go. Today he was cut and hard, he had good color, and he posed adequately, but he failed to make an impression. He has good abs for a big man and several other good body parts, but as a total package, he presents an odd and ungainly put-together physique. 17th, Robbie Robinson from the USA. The Black Prince of Bodybuilding sporting a Grace Jones haircut showed up in probably the worst shape ever for an Olympia contest. It wasn't that he was fat or anything like that, but compared to the Robbie of 6 or 7 years ago, when Robbie was the head honcho and the man to beat, the Robbie I saw today was but a shadow of his former self. He was smooth, especially when relaxed, and definitely holding water. Also, during the prejudging, he kept doing compulsory poses wrong, and he had to be corrected several times as to the proper way of doing the compulsory poses. As far as feet and hand position, one wonders how an old season pro like Robbie would forget how to do the compulsory poses. His free posing routine was dull and lifeless. It's sad because here's a man with the genetic potential to do well. 16th, Charles Glass from the USA. Charles Glass was another disappointment to me. His rock-hard muscularity, which he showed at last year's Mr. Universe, was not in evidence today. Perhaps he felt wrongly that he had to have more size in order to be competitive in the Olympia, and the additional size smoothed him out a bit. Under the harsh lights, he seemed washed out, and even his color seemed pale. While tensing, he looked cut and hard, but when he was relaxed, he was just too smooth. His posing was short, but created some excitement because it contained two backflips and a planche move. 15th, Bill Grant from the USA and Sweden. There were a lot of disappointed people at this contest on Saturday, November 3rd, but few more disappointed than Bill Grant. His girlfriend told me Bill did not expect to crack the top six, but he did expect to make the top 10 and be in the money. 10th would have earned Bill $1,000. When Wayne D'Amelio announced the top 10 finalists, Bill's name was called out, and then a few minutes later, a correction was made, and Bill was off the list. Talk about being built up only to come crashing down. Before the contest, Bill told me he was 10 pounds heavier than he was at the World Championships in Toronto in February, where he placed third, and he obviously felt he had to pack on extra size, which only smoothed him out. The hardness of muscle, especially when relaxed, just was not there, and Bill's skin appeared too light on stage. Apparently, he had trouble tanning while living and training in Sweden. 14th, Chuck Williams from the USA. After winning his class at the Mr. Universe last year, defeating the likes of Tim Belknap, great things were expected of Chuck at the Olympia. But like Glass, Grant, and so many others, he showed up in less than tip-top form. He was cut and hard, but not ripped. It was unfortunate because he had great arms, good legs, chest, abs, and back, and overall muscularity and good balance. All the ingredients to do well. But as I've said so many times in this article, being cut isn't enough anymore. You got to be ripped to the bone with chiseled separation, dazzling definition, and rock-hard muscularity. And that's not even enough to guarantee a top six finish anymore. And Williams wasn't. At a lesser contest, his form would have put him in one of the top spots, but here he got 14th. That shows how tough the Olympia is. Chuck, too, probably tried to gain a little too much extra size and it ended up sacrificing his cuts and vascularity. 13th, Boyer Coe, USA. This was Boyer's first Olympia in 2 years, and it was nice to see him return to action. In 1982 in London, Boyer made a mistake of coming in too light, sacrificing size and density, and he finished out of the money. I saw Boyer in the lobby of the hotel, and he was definitely heavier than 1982, but I couldn't tell what kind of shape he was in. I felt if he approached the fantastic shape he displayed at the 1980 Mr. Olympia or the 1981 Grand Prix in Atlantic City in Montreal, then he'd really give everyone a scare and be in the running for top spots. But this was not to be. Even when Bowyer posed one of his usual strong points, some of the co-magic was gone. Today, Bowyer had fairly good color, could have been darker, and he posed well, but he lacked his usual punch. And he had all his usual strong features, great arms and calves. But with Bowyer's structure, he has to be in super shape to do well, and it wasn't the case today. He, too, like so many others, was fairly cut and hard, but not ripped. His abs were weak, and his waist appeared wide and thick, and his thighs were not in top shape. All these factors accounted for his low place. 12. Tony Pearson. Sporting a new nose to emphasize his Michael Jackson resemblance and excellent posing to Billie Jean were not enough to get Pearson into the top 10. Tony hadn't even qualified for the Mr. Olympia, having never won either an IFBB Mr. Universe or Grand Prix event. But due to his strong showing in several recent contests, he requested special permission to enter the Olympia, and his request was granted. I wonder why Scott Wilson, who actually did win an IFBB Grand Prix event, didn't do the same thing. Pearson was cut and hard too, but not his usual ripped self. Under the harsh lights, he seemed a tad soft, especially when relaxed and a little washed out. Even his skin color seemed a little light. His calves were still down, but his abs were very sharp. His vacuum shot was excellent. And of course, he had the best lat spread in the entire show. When he tensed his thighs, you got to see striations, so you knew he was in shape. 11th, Chris Dickerson from the USA. Finishing just one place out of the money must have been especially frustrating for Chris. As a former Mr. Olympia winner, I'm sure he expected to do much better. I'm curious as to why Chris decided to come out of retirement and make a comeback in this contest. When he retired, he went out on top, and he had more to lose than to gain by competing today. In the past, Chris won so often due to his symmetry, cuts, and presentation, and the intangible qualities that made him great. His charisma, winning attitude, professionalism, and experience. But today, a two-year absence from competition had dulled the intangible qualities, and he was literally overwhelmed by the youth and muscularity of the younger stars. Still, ever the consummate professional, today Chris presented us with a pleasing physique and a typically fine Dickerson posing routine. I thought his juxtaposition of classical poses with modern breakdance moves especially good, even if his moonwalks were poorly done. A few years ago, he probably would have finished much higher, but today he seemed to get overlooked and lost in the crowd. In only 2 years since he last competed, the judges are demanding a more ripped look and muscular physique. Being 2 years older and out of competition 2 years took its toll, and Chris seemed the forgotten man of the contest. Personally, I had him 10th, but any way you look at it, it was a sad day for a former Mr. Olympia. In 10th, Tom Flats from the USA, $1,000. Tom was originally given 9th, and then he was, after the show, changed to 10th. I spoke with Tom briefly at the judges' meeting the night before the contest, and I told him he might be the surprise of the contest, as due to his bicep injury, he had been overlooked. Looking like the cat that swallowed the canary, Tom smiled shyly at me and told me that I was right. Almost shaking with excitement, Tom replied that, "I can't wait to pose tomorrow," giving weight and substance to the rumor that he was in fantastic shape. Some said he was at his all-time best shape, and Muscle and Power magazine was picking him to win the Olympia. Thus it was I felt a little sad for Tom today. When he walked onto stage, he received a tremendous ovation, but the ovation seemed to die a bit once he started to pose, which had nothing to do with his posing. It was good. For although Tom had excellent color and he was extremely cut and muscular, maybe even ripped, his injured bicep was still down, and his ponderous thighs, as cut and striated as they are, seemed even bigger than when I last saw them in London 2 years ago, and it upset his balance. I don't know why Tom still does squats and other mass leg movements. If I had legs like him, all I'd do is different styles of leg extensions and leg curls, and that would be it for thighs, and I'd spend the extra time on upper body work. As it is, his legs should be featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not. I should add that Tom was the only one who seemed to have really fun on stage, and he and Sergio were the only ones to show any aggressiveness in fight. 9th, Bob Birdsong, $1,500. Today, Bob was probably at his all-time best, and he had one of the best bodies in the entire show. He was almost flawless, physically, that is. He had a deep, dark, rich tan and fantastic skin tone. His shape and symmetry were beautiful. Great separation, full round muscle bellies, and good size were all qualities he had in abundance. Besides that, he was ripped and hard as steel. but even his usually hard-to-cut-up thighs were striated and cut today. Individually, each one of his body parts was superb. Legs, abs, arms, chest, delts, and back. And as a whole package, he had all the qualities to be a top three finisher. But for some reason, Bob lacks charisma and stage presence, and his posing to the music of Ghostbusters, to be quite honest, was pitiful. It made him look oafish, awkward, and clumsy. He tried to dance to the music, a la Beckles or Grant, but he just couldn't pull it off. It was too bad because Bob deserved much better today. Eighth place, Sergio Oliva, USA, $2,000. I have more mixed emotions about Sergio's placing eighth today than any other contestant. As most Muscle Mag readers know, I did a large two-part article on the myth earlier in the year. I've come to feel close to Sergio and his wife, Arlene, and I have much affection for both of them. I phoned them every few weeks the last few months before the contest to check on Sergio's condition and see how he was coming along and to see how Arlene was, who was pregnant. So frankly, when Sergio was called for eighth, I felt very sad for him. I know how disappointed he was. Personal feelings aside, I had Sergio fifth or sixth. I overheard Ben Weider tell Bob Kennedy he thought Sergio should have been fifth. Physically, it looked to me as if Sergio was holding a little water under his skin. He sweated gallons under the hot lights during the prejudging and thus appeared a little sharper at the night show than in the afternoon's prejudging. Also, his legs were down a bit in size as a knee injury prevented him from training his thighs as he would have liked. But don't get the impression that Sergio was bad or out of shape. Like so many others, he was cut and hard, but he didn't have the super cuts in definition of the top three or four. To his credit, unlike some of the other black contestants like Glass, Williams, Pearson, and Grant, who failed to tan and were washed out a bit under the posing lights, Sergio had excellent color. The biggest difference I noticed between Sergio and Lee Haney was that Sergio's muscles were large but flat, while Haney's seemed full and as if to be bursting through his skin. Haney's water was obviously inside his muscles, while Sergio's appeared drawn while still holding water under his skin. I thought Sergio posed very well, and I'm sure he surprised a lot of people with his posing. Even Vince Gironda commented that he thought Sergio posed well. Also, Sergio was the most aggressive man on stage, and he seemed to be the only one to want to mix it up. When he hit some of his most muscular and classic Oliva overhead poses during the prejudging, it almost started a riot. All through the contest, Sergio seemed to be the crowd favorite, and without him in the pose down, it seemed watered down and dull. When he was finally announced in eighth, the crowd rose in unison and gave him a long standing ovation as cries of "Sergio, Sergio" ran through the room. This brought on one of the most touching moments of the entire show when Sergio's wife, Arlene, helped by Rick Wayne, passed up their new two-week-old baby boy, Sergio Jr., to Sergio on stage. Holding the baby, Sergio went to the microphone and he told the audience what he was holding was worth more than any Mr. Olympia title. Sergio said he had no bitterness or gripe with the IFBB, and he wanted to wish the other contestants well. And it didn't matter if he came first, eighth, or last, he was still the myth. Everyone in the auditorium, including the remaining competitors on stage, gave him a long and loud applause. A true gentleman is Sergio Oliva. I might add here that during the prejudging, each time Sergio was called out for comparisons, he always shook the other two bodybuilders' hands. He was the only one to do so. So in the final analysis, let it be said that Sergio did not disgrace himself as everyone predicted he would. He wasn't in quite good enough shape to finish in the top three or four, but he was cut and hard and possibly should have been in the top six. He gave everyone a big thrill and he should be proud of his accomplishment. I know I am, and I'm proud of him. Seventh, Bob Paris from the USA, $2,500. This was Bob's first Olympia and he made quite an impression on both the judges and the fans alike. There have been great expectations of Bob, and he didn't let his fans down as he came in with good cuts, excellent shape and symmetry, good color, and he posed very smoothly and professionally. With his exceptional good looks, symmetry, and clean lines reminiscent of the great Reeves himself, with more seasoning and training, Bob will surely be a top contender for the Olympia in a few more years. Sixth, Samir Banut, USA, $3,000. When Samir was called for sixth place, he almost fell through the floor. I myself was shocked that Samir only got sixth. I thought he'd take fourth or fifth at the very worst. Before the show, Frank Zane had congratulated Samir backstage on his magnificent condition, and several competitors also apparently shook his hand in what turned out to be premature congratulations. When Samir walked on stage in round one of the prejudging, he appeared supremely confident, very hard and cut, but not super ripped as the last two previous Olympias. Also, he appeared a little light under the harsh lights, and he seemed to hold a little amount of water under his skin, and this was enough to spell doom for Benoit. I heard he gained 8 pounds since last year, and it was obviously too much for his structure. But that's not to say Samir was smooth. He was still one of the top physiques in the whole show, and when he tensed, he appeared very muscular indeed, and his symmetry and proportions were near flawless. But the relaxed position, he wasn't as hard or ripped as McAway, Haney, Wilkosch, or Beckles. Samir had set such a high standard when he won the title last year that anything less than his best was not good enough for the judges. Personally, I think the judges were a little hard on Samir, and he deserved better. Look out for him next year. Fifth, Roy Callender from Barbados, $4,000. Probably the biggest surprise in the whole show to me was Roy placing fifth ahead of people like Samir, Sergio, Paris, and Birdsong, and it's only real major dispute I have with the judges' decisions. To be perfectly honest, I didn't even have Big Roy in my top 10. I was very surprised when he kept getting called out for comparisons in the prejudging, and even more shocked when he made the top six. I'd like to know what the judges saw in him that I couldn't see. Today, Roy seemed heavy and smooth, especially in his thighs, which made his small calves seem even smaller. In 1981 in Columbus, Ohio, Roy showed up ripped to the bone, and he only got fourth place when everyone agreed that either he or Tom Platt should have won. That was a very bad break for Roy, but today things evened out as he actually got an equally lucky break to finish in the top six. Ironically, Roy did a fantastic choreographed posing routine, the absolute best I've ever seen him pose in four or five occasions. Fourth, Albert Beckles from Britain, $6,000. Well, the old man did it again, showing up in New York in very ripped condition that was enough to earn him a well-deserved fourth. Yes, his calves were still down a bit in size, and he has a few other minor structural flaws, but damn it, when he hits the double bicep pose from the front or back, it's an amazing sight to behold. Al's back was etched in stone, and his arms, abs, and whole upper torso was fantastic. Third, Josef Wilkosch from Germany, $10,000. Josef was a solid third today. His size was colossal as ever, and he had managed to gain size without sacrificing cuts. I think the biggest improvement came in his legs, which were bigger, but also more cut and muscular and very vascular. To me, Josef appeared to be the hardest physique in the entire show, especially in the relaxed position, with deep etched cuts, good color, and unbelievable vascularity and muscularity. For a big man, his abs were especially fantastic. His posing still lacked the energy and beauty of McAway, and his expression was stoic and bland, but it was no means poor. Next to Haney, Wilkosch impressed me more than anyone in the entire show. Second place, Mohamed McAway from Canada, $20,000. For the second year in a row, Mohamed had to be satisfied with second, and I know he was devastated by the result. Devastated because if he wasn't at his all-time best, he was very close, and he realistically can't get much better. And if his best wasn't good enough to beat Haney, then why continue to compete? McAway is not the kind of guy who can be satisfied with second, even if it does net him $20,000. As usual, he presented a superb total package for the judges to ponder. Beautiful shape and classic symmetry, deep etched cuts and separation, fantastic overall muscularity, beautiful tan and skin tone, artistic posing, a confident fighting spirit, and professionalism second to none. If he wasn't the best physique in the show, he never showed it. First place, Lee Haney, USA, $50,000. From the moment Lee walked on stage in the afternoon prejudging until the final pose down at night, he looked like the winner to me, and virtually everyone else. His monstrous size overwhelmed everybody, judges and fans alike. He was huge all over, hard, ripped, and proportionate. He seemed to dwarf even the other big bodybuilders in the show. As I mentioned earlier, his muscles were full and seemed to be bursting through his thin black skin. He appeared to be at his best, just standing relaxed. His free posing was adequate and will improve with time. People forget Lee's only 23. His win today could be the start of another Schwarzenegger-like hold on the Olympia trophy. Certainly, it's hard to foresee anyone beating Haney for a long time, and being so young, he's only bound to improve more and more as he matures. Gary Bartley remarked after the show that this was only Lee's second year since turning pro, and he had never seen Lee make a major mistake in competition. He's only going to get smarter and better each year he competes. Who's going to beat him? Well, that wraps up another Olympia. Just a few extra comments. John Bailey commented that the lighting at this Olympia was the worst he'd ever seen at a Mr. Olympia. It made just about everyone look washed out. And the lights were so hot that it was actually burning the competitors' feet. They actually had to move the competitors off stage because the bottoms of their feet were burning so badly. You'd think that at the Olympia, they'd find someone to get the lighting right. All in all, an exciting show. All right. Long, good report from Greg Zulak. Correction, Lee was 24 when he won Mr. Olympia. He was born in 1959, and it was right before his 25th birthday, I think about a week before. So Arnold was still the youngest Mr. Olympia winner at 23, but Lee was only 1 year behind him at 24. All right, let's go to our second article. This one's from Muscle and Fitness, February 1985. Jeff Everson wrote this. It says, Mr. Olympia, hands down, it's Haney. McAway runner-up, Samir sixth. They say the city that never sleeps has 1,100 taxis. Not one of them has shocks and springs. But bumpy rides are of no consequence in the bustling streets of the Big Apple. Your life is your major concern. Flex's Jerry Candela, Sports Fitness's Fred Hatfield, and I find that out quickly on Saturday morning, the day of the 1984 Mr. Olympia prejudging. The taxi crash happened so fast, none of us recalls the details. But we assure you, we remember the post-crash argument, as well as we do the monthly sales of Flex, Muscle and Fitness, and Sports Fitness. The two recalcitrant drivers both blamed each other's use of drugs for the accident. The driver of the opposing cab denied that his use of drugs made any difference at all. After all, he'd taken drugs every night for 8 years, and he hadn't had so much as a fender bender during the entire time. Our driver, who reeked of alcohol and navigated while watching Entertainment Tonight on his dash-mounted TV, offered three back-to-back 8-hour shifts as his excuse. I suffered no whiplash. I was transporting a 40-pound box of new Weider Mr. Olympia medallions. Failure to deliver them on time would surely have cost me my roll-top oak desk in the building Alan Dolphin calls home. So I paid my fare and slipped inconspicuously into the crowds. New York is used to crowds. Crowded taxis, crowded shops, 50% of which are going out of business. Crowds in every street. And now a new crowd. The one forming around totally awesome Lee Haney, Mr. Olympia 1984. A fortnight before the contest, Lee told photog John Balick, I don't know what I did, John. All I know is I'm 253 pounds, harder and bigger than ever before, and still cut like a knife. Indeed, at 5'11 and 243 pounds on the day of the show, Lee Haney cast one ominous-looking shadow. We should have known. While training at World's Gym in Santa Monica and Gold's Gym in Reseda with Dragon Slayer Richard Gaspari, Haney had openly boasted that he would squash the life out of Mohamed Makaway and Samir Banoot, whom he regarded as his prime opponents this year. As the months passed, we watched in awe as Lee grew. Other gym members looked on, stupefied by his training intensity. No one in modern bodybuilding ever possessed such enormous pectorals, upper back, and mountainous deltoids. Contests, however, aren't necessarily won on the size of a man's pecs. Hadn't McCauley and Banute proved that in 83 when they defeated Haney in Munich? We would soon find out, wouldn't we? Here come the judge. Inside the Felt Forum Hall, near pandemonium was happening. Promoters D'Amelio, Clark, and Levine dashed frenziedly about as hundreds of entertainment seekers tried desperately to secure tickets. But the ticket situation was tighter than Gladys Portuguese jeans. Ben Weider stayed calm. He had the duty of ensuring both competitors and crowd that the seven judges selected were the finest the IFBB could muster. Ben revealed to the audience that the judges came from seven different countries and had been unanimously approved by the athletes the evening before. Ah, but the crowd would wait until the judging itself before rendering their verdict. Meanwhile, the world's greatest flaunting of flesh was about to begin. Outside, crowds of starry-eyed youngsters gathered, swooning over the size of Albert Beckel's arms and mobbing Lou Ferrigno, Franco Colombo, and a certain irrepressible Cuban named Oliva. The myth returns. Bodybuilding's Lazarus has risen. And Jesus spoke, take ye away the stone. And then Jesus cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus, who was dead, came forth bound in grave cloths. John 10:11. The many bodybuilding fans, Sergio Oliva, had been laid to rest long ago. Trouble was, no one bothered to tell Sergio that. Still, we all feared the worst. Various reports had Sergio weighing 262 pounds, big but devoid of separation and cuts. Some even speculated that the Myth would not compete at all, but would show up and expect Doe to do an exhibition. The reports were all wrong. Sergio showed up. God, how he showed up. I shivered when Oliva came out, drawing the first position. "He ain't human," someone shouted out. I thought, of course not. Sergio's never been human. Where's this guy been all these years? Moving with singular grace and elegance, Sergio cast his Liston-like stare at the masses, strode graciously to the posing dais, and began. It was immediately obvious that he wouldn't be as hard or as ripped as some of the other competitors, but no one cared, least of all Sergio. As he posed, his body's bulging mass shook with the effort. He had spent one full hour pumping up. Gone were the incredibly thick thighs that once rivaled Platz's. Gone, too, was the taut skin of a younger man. Sergio, according to inside reports, was older than Albert Beckles. How old is that? No one else remembers. Some said 55 was close. Despite his lack of Haney hardness, there's something appealing about Oliva's body. He has incredible, beautiful shape and proportion, with tiny, tiny joints, which make his massive muscles seem larger than they already are. His deltoids, pectorals, and arms match Haney's in size, and he was, oh, so wide. This was Oliva at only 70% of his 1972 shape. Still, he was fantastic. At the end of his routine, Sergio jumped down off the stage and began hitting his trademark, most muscular, and arms elevated over the head shots in front of the judges. Oliva was telling everyone, "Enough shit. This is the mass that makes bodybuilding great." Later on, when Sergio was announced eighth, the crowd erupted into applause and kept applauding, giving Oliva the only standing ovation of the evening. The competitors joined as the crowd chanted, "Sergio, Sergio, Sergio." Their respect for this man overwhelmed me. As I saw the end of an era, damn if a tear didn't roll down the side of my cheek. I looked over at my good friend Ricky Wayne, who sat a couple of seats in front of me. The emotion of the moment had carried Rick out of his seat to the corner of the stage as he shouted superlatives toward the smiling Oliva. Perhaps the greatest bodybuilder who ever lived basked in this shower of respect and love. Sergio held up his new baby in his big, gentle hands and went to the microphone. "Eighth place, 17th, 1st, or 20th, it makes no matter to me. I will forever be the Myth, and in my hands here I hold the next Myth." The crowd rejoiced as this man of dignity, this man who never traded his integrity for cash, left the stage a champion. Haney, head and shoulders above the rest. From the very moment he stepped on stage as number 17, everyone knew Lee Haney would be the next Mr. Olympia. He was that good. Not only was he the most massive and hardest man in the show, he clearly had the most ripped body. There were no weak body parts, a claim only a few others could make. Somehow in the last year, Lee has entered a new physique dimension, a dimension that separates a great bodybuilder from all the rest. Everything was there in proportionate excess. The crisp abdominals, the sweeping cut-up thighs, the oh-my-God thickness in the back, an opposing confidence not seen before. Straight away, we knew that the battle was now for second place and that Mr. Haney might be conceivably go on as Mr. Olympia forever. Muhammad goes to the mountain. By any stretch of wild imagination, Muhammad Makawe is no giant of muscle mass. Nevertheless, he went right after Haney, undaunted in the pose down and comparisons. If ever a bodybuilder has learned to get everything possible out of a posing round, it's Muhammad. Here is a man who, when standing relaxed, looks like a fifth-place finisher in the Mr. Idaho. Yet when he poses, all hell breaks loose. When he stands in a double biceps front pose, it's apparent that no bodybuilder past or present has biceps and triceps so big on a frame so small. His deltoids seem bigger than his head. By rising and falling into archer-type poses with the peaks and valleys of his music, Makawe draws your attention away from his not-so-great trapezius, middle back, and hamstrings, and divert your eye toward his strengths instead. Other competitors may pose, but Makawe directs a muscle symphony. He represents what physique display is all about, and he justifiably banked the second place $20,000. The lion gets tamed. This time, there was no Androcles to pull the thorn from the lion's paw. Samir Banut slipped to sixth place, even if the audience would have rated him much higher. The defending champ suffered the fate of following Oliva. His posing was good, but a bit rushed, and he shook nervously. Samir wasn't as honed in his legs and arms as he had been in the past, but his abdominals and striated back were in full force. Samir visibly improved as the day wore on, but by the time of the evening show, he looked better than a sixth place finish, but the damage had already been done. It had been a long and trying year with exhibitions and travels, but the Lion of Lebanon will return. Maybe he won't visit Belgium, but any man who is only as old as Albert Beckel's son has plenty of competition left. Beckel's baffled, Birdsong blundered. Tell me, what weak body parts do Albert Beckel's and Bob Birdsong have? Albert may have some unusually shaped body parts, but unlike other competitors, they are all developed. So what if his biceps are shorter than bent grass on a golf green? They are magnificent anyway. I rated Beckel second, but then again, as I'm fond of saying, I'm no James Mannion. When ageless Albert hits his back and side tricep chest poses, you know we're talking grade A beef. No one has finer intercostals, serratus, or pectoral striations. Albert did everything he did earlier in the year in Toronto. He beat the same competitors and a few others, but he got beat by some of the same guys who bested him in Munich last year. His fourth place finish was roundly booed, but not nearly as loudly as Bob Birdsong's 10th. Birdsong is getting to be something of an enigma. Each show he looks better and better, and each show he seems overlooked. By the Mr. O, he gained yet more cut-up mass with the same proportionate shape and fearful symmetry. Unfortunately, he's unable to project the necessary charisma required to move higher. Bob blundered on his choice of music and posing style. Ghostbusters just isn't right for a Mr. Olympia show. It's more of a dance exhibition type song. Bob put some dance moves into his posing, but they appeared out of sync and they lacked direction. Champion Lydia Chang, sitting in front of me, was visibly embarrassed and wondered why, with all the money at stake, these professionals don't bother to hire a good choreographer. I second her opinion. Bob Birdsong has such a masterful body that it's a shame he can't project it better. A post-contest poll of writers, photographers, and aficionados showed that they consider Birdsong badly placed and that they would have put Bob in the top five. You will like this guy, that is for sure. The fans wanted mass and size, and Josip Lukacs accommodated them. He looked like something from a Wagner-induced fantasy. With Bertel Fox back in California nursing a broken psyche secondary to a bad case of lumbago, Josip provided the mass backup to Haney and Oliva. Early on, it was obvious the judges were looking at Haney, Makawe, and Josip for the top three, with Beckels occasionally drifting in and out of the comparisons too. The big German was in his best shape. He had the best long-bellied, full latissimus development with powerful-looking traps and rear deltoids. Obviously a throwback to his days of imitating fellow German Rudolf Main. Like Tony Pearson and Robbie Robinson, Josip was outwardly relaxed but posed with interior fire. His only relative weakness may have been lower quads related to his chronic knee pain and a bit of loose extra skin on the lower back, which is common for former Olympic lifters. His third place finish for $10,000 was his highest ever, and he accepted without protest by the audience, especially the highly partisan German contingent led by Herr Albert Busek. The other Barbados beauty. Roy Callender in fifth place was the real surprise of the show, except for Franco's impromptu posing and that of the Stevie Wonder of bodybuilding, Mr. Universe Mike Christian. A close friend of Albert Beckel's whispered to me, "I think I'm looking at Albert up there." Although there are differences in hamstring structure, but Roy has the upper body structure and skin tone of Albert, both beautiful. Callender has the best hamstring development in the game with impressive round and full muscle bellies. He was at his finest honed down with sweeping thick lats, sharp waist, great thigh thickness, and fine skin tone. All these parameters accounted for his fifth place $4,000 finish. Welcome back to the fray, Roy. The Golden Eagle soars, even with clipped wings. When the show's MC admonished us to go insane when the next performer, we knew it could only be one man, Tom Platz. And as usual, Platz grabbed the New York audience by their collective throats, lifted them out of their seats, and scattered them about the aisles. The consummate showman, Platz adopted his humorous Hulk stance, tightened his ridge-like rectus abdominis and rectus femoris, and blew the cross-strated minds of the spectators into quadriceps heaven. The fans unceremoniously freaked out whenever Tom was called for comparisons. He was in as good a shape as he can be, unlike some of the others who had missed their elusive peaks. Platts and Oliva caused the first emotional outburst of the prejudging when, during the mandatory round, Oliva got sick and tired of protocol and banged out a most muscular alongside of Platts and McElwain. Don't ask me the genesis of that comparison. Platts responded with a three-quarter back shot, and the orgasmic throng went insane, just as they had earlier been ordered to do. Oliva, continuing his defiance of this damnable new style of posing, unleashed his trademark arms-over-the-head shot. Then Platts nailed the quadricep special. The eager fans shifted into outright bedlam. Finally, Jacques Blumhardt called Platts to task, telling him politely to leave well enough alone. Tom, no dunce, did. Although Tom finished in the top 10, ninth, the fans, according to my informal survey, placed him third, behind Beckles and Haney. Such is the appeal of the Golden Eagle. Joe Gold failed to play Gene Dixon this time, so we can only guess where Bob Paris would place. Rick Wayne, however, had gone on record saying that Mr. Paris, if he came in at the right weight, might do a lot to upset the Haney-Benute apple cart. Bob came in as good shape, but he lacked the mass to stop the Haney Express. Locomotives are heavier than apple carts, and Paris's good lines and symmetry weren't enough to crack the top five on this, his first Mr. Olympia effort. Still, Paris has the look many bodybuilders would gladly exchange their somatotins for. He's elegant, shapely, and smooth. He's also the youngest man to compete in the Mr. Olympia at a tender 23. Bob's posing routine was exquisitely unique, rivaling McAway's performance. Naturally, the crowd thought that he would finish higher, but seventh place in your first Mr. Olympia is nothing to hide your head for, or God forbid, shave it. Paris accepted his $2,500 placidly and hid any disappointment. The world's 10 second best built men. Finishing out of the direct line of IRS scrutiny were Robbie Robinson, Hubert Metz, Bill Grant, Chris Dickerson, Tony Pearson, Chuck Williams, Charles Glass, Boyer Coe, James Gobert, and Appy Steenbeck. Robbie Robinson, like Oliva, Dickerson, and Coe, was playing the part of Lazarus too. The reborn Black Prince was probably the happiest non-placer in the show. He made no secret of his exuberance at being back, embracing both Tom Platts and Joe Weider on stage. Robbie had the biceps, abdominals, and lats of old, but he needed deeper cuts in his thighs. I doubt that he cared. This was a much-needed step back in the right direction for him. Bill Grant came with international airline ticket problems once again, but his supersonic biceps and abdominals were no problem at all. Grant stated in Toronto that his one ambition had been fulfilled. He couldn't have been happier just to be competing in the Mr. O. Unfortunately, by missing the top 10, he'll have to earn his entry to the 1985 Mr. Olympia by a different route. Chris Dickerson's comeback was a surprise. Halfway into his training, Chris still hadn't figured out why he chose to do it. Still, with just 3 months of hard training and a new moonwalk posing routine, he had whipped himself into suitable shape, and he just missed out on the top 10. As with the sideline Frank Zane, next year might be a different script. Tony Pearson, was in a slightly sleeked down version of his Toronto condition, but he brought along his wide back and the grooviest, most muscular shot in the business. Tony simply lacks enough mass to finish in the money right now, but he sure doesn't lack class, that's for sure. He got a resounding ovation from the New York audience for his Billie Jean routine. Chuck Williams, a.k.a. the Prophet of Mass, Charles Glass, and Appy Steenbeck were all bigger and healthier looking than when they competed as amateurs a year ago. Chuck had his usual upper body mass, and Steenbeck had the best vascularity and definition of the trio of new pros. Charles Glass pulled out the stops with a backflip, back handspring, and front lever, but it wasn't quite massive enough for the top 10. Hubert Metz, the other West German, had pectorals equaling Haney's, but he looked almost lean because of his height and structure. He also either has high blood pressure, higher than the front row ticket prices, or he must have been lost in a niacin factory. Other than his red flush, he looked to be in the best competitive shape ever. Boyer Coe had thankfully dropped Eye of the Tiger as posing music and had come to New York, like Dickerson, with a minimum of pre-contest training. Still, he looked impressive, like the Coe of old. Unfortunately, bodybuilders keep getting more massive, and Boyer wasn't quite there this time. I waited all night for it, and it took the last man to do it, James Gobert, posed to Frank Sinatra's New York, New York, gliding smoothly through the real classy posing routine, the man with the abdominals. When did he find time to train while running the MPC Nationals in New Orleans at the same time? Provided a fitting ending to an evening show. All right, that was Jeff Everson's report, a little bit more positive than Greg Zulak's report. All right, let's go to article number 3, and this comes from the original Iron Man, one that was still published by Perry and Mabel Rader, and this is the March 1985 issue. Great picture of Muhammad Mukawi on the cover, but I think that was from the 1983 Mr. Olympia, not the 1984. And so this article is titled simply Mr. Olympia, and it was written by Gary Bartlett. So here we go. It says, Gary, I really want to thank you for the great cover shot on Iron Man magazine. As I gazed up into the serious face of massive Lee Haney, I was caught off guard by his statement. It was on the eve of the biggest bodybuilding event of the year. I mean, here is a man who is favored to win the Olympia, and he's thoughtful enough to remember past favors. Lee, I replied, why would you thank me for only a cover on Iron Man? I mean, you are on every other page of Flex and Muscle and Fitness magazine. The publicity you've gained from those magazines far outweighs anything that Iron Man could ever do. Gary, I understand that. Joe's magazines have been very good for me, and I appreciate what they've done, but Iron Man magazine was one of the first mags that I read, and I've always enjoyed it. Getting my photo on the cover just meant something special to me. Lee Haney, our new 84 Mr. Olympia, has a character and personality of a true champion. What a stroke of luck that his first Iron Man cover was published on the issue that broke around the date of the 1984 Mr. Olympia. For Lee to acknowledge thanks on the night before the Big O while so many others rush into the hotel without so much as a handshake makes him someone special. The others are thankless for past publicity and are only concerned with rushing to their rooms so they can hide and worry about tomorrow's show. Not so with the awesome Lee Haney. The man has not only a champion's physique, but more importantly, he has one huge champion's heart. Perhaps that's why he has such an enormous chest. The IFBB Joe Weider's Mr. Olympia contest would be celebrating its 20th year anniversary. Perhaps it would be appropriate that this event should return to good old New York City under the guidance of top IFBB promoter Wayne D'Amelio. Most of us who are veterans of the Mr. Olympia remember that this is where all the big early battles of the Big O originally happened, with the likes of Scott, Poole, and the myth Sergio Oliva battling it out. Even the great Schwarzenegger flexed more than his share of biceps on the New York stage. The 1984 Mr. Olympia would present us with many surprises, with the most important one being a new dawn for this event. Many new champions were made, while many of our past champs would be buried and left behind. We would even see legends shattered and new ones created. There was much talk and speculation in the days preceding the event as to who might win. As the list of competitors poured in, it was evident that we were going to have the most competitive Olympia to date, with many of our past Grand Prix and Olympia champions back. In fact, the list of competitors looked like a who's who of the top five finishers of most pro events over the past 5 years. Almost all of them had won at least one big pro show. Yes, we would also have our also-rans, who only qualified to compete based on their world champion win. I feel that these champions were really out of place, with the exception of a couple. Unfortunately, the contest would not be perfect as we were expecting the hulking Bertil Fox to compete, but at the last minute, reports indicated that he would be absent. Regardless, the stage at the Felt Forum would be lined with over 20 of the world's best pro bodybuilders. Let's briefly review each man and the order he placed. 20th place, Appy Steenbeck. Steenbeck is an unfamiliar face in pro bodybuilding. He is qualified to compete in the Olympia because of his 83 world champion lightweight class win. Considering Appy's limited potential and mediocre appearance on stage with the likes of our current pro champions, it was obvious that Appy was in the wrong place. 19th, James Gobert. This is James Gobert's second Olympia, and at last year's event in Germany, he presented quite a respectable package. Today, I felt James was well off his Germany condition, which was obvious by his very low placing. 18th, Hubert Metz. I felt that Hubert was definitely off his best condition, which at best still limits his placing. Hubert just is outclassed, and his potential as a pro bodybuilder is very much in question. 17th, Robbie Robinson. Perhaps my first major disappointment of the 84 event was to witness the poor condition of Robinson. Unlike Metz, Robbie has the potential to win this event. In the past, he's finished second and won several New York Night of the Champions events. Today, he was flat, smooth, and definitely out of Olympia shape. A sad tribute to one of our best past champions. 16th, Charles Glass. Charles was our last year's middleweight world champion. Today, he would show us the excellent physique that won him that title. Charles was ripped, hard, and ready, but unfortunately he lacks the necessary bulk and huge size to really compete with the big guns. In spite of this, Charles gave a good accounting of himself, especially when he did a full backflip during his posing routine. 15th, Bill Grant. Bill worked hard, earning the right to compete at this Olympia by finishing in the top three of the 84 men's pro championships. Unfortunately, the competition at that show and the Olympia are very different. Bill was thicker and in his usual rip condition, but the competition was just that much greater. 14th, Chuck Williams. This is the first time I've ever seen Williams compete. He is the 83 light heavyweight world champion, and it was easy to see that the photos of his outstanding arms were not exaggerated. Chuck's arms are a bodybuilder's dream. Today, I felt Chuck could have been a bit sharper. Also, he needs to add a bit more size on the rest of his physique to match those massive arms. Chuck could be a man to watch in future events. 13th, Boyer Coe. I was saddened to see my old friend Boyer Coe play so low in his comeback attempt. His last Olympia was in London 2 years ago, where he appeared too drawn, resulting in a low placing at that time. Seeing Boyer the evening before in the hotel lobby, I felt that he had regained his former thick size and was ready. In fact, at past events, Boyer always placed very high. I suspected that Boyer would be one of the surprises of the 84 Olympia. Unfortunately, Boyer had indeed gained his former size and bulk, but in doing this, he just missed being ripped. All the famous Coe poses and form were evident, but he just missed his peak, resulting in a trifle smooth appearance. 12th, Tony Pearson. Sporting his new Michael Jackson look, Tony strode on stage to the music of Beat It, giving one the feeling that he was watching a bulked-up Michael Jackson doing a posing routine. Tony was in outstanding shape, ripped and lean. His cuts have always been one of his best attributes. And recently, in an effort to gain more size, I felt that Tony had lost a bit of those famous cuts. Today, they were back in full force. It's unfortunate that the competition was so keen that Tony was not able to make the top 10 in his first Olympia. 11th, Chris Dickerson. How frustrating it must have been for our 82 Mr. Olympia to place out of the top 10. I think this was the first time since Chris entered into IFBB competition where he finished lower than second. In the 79 Olympia, he finished sixth. I guess it goes to show you that you can come back once successfully, but a second time is too much to ask. Nevertheless, it was great to see Chris back performing his magic posing in the city where he had done it many times before and winning his many Grand Prix victories. Although the old Dickerson form was evident, he failed to display the deep thickness and density that won him this title in the past. It was not easy to regain enough size after a two-year layoff from competition and compete against the likes of Haney. 10th place, Tom Platz. I hope I get this right because it was announced that Platz was 9th during the evening show. However, Sunday morning I was told that a mistake had been made and that Tom was really 10th. Anyway, I will list Tom as 10th. Perhaps no other young star has captured the imagination of all hardcore bodybuilders like the Golden Eagle, Tom Platz. Tom captured all that is the essence of bodybuilding: determination, hard work, and the competitive spirit. Tom, more than anything else, wanted the Olympia. Unfortunately, fate dealt him a dirty hand, resulting in that severe biceps injury 2 years ago. This setback definitely put a roadblock to Tom's ambitions, and it looks as though his dream is now further away. I felt that Tom's placing at this year's Olympia must have been a disappointment to him. Certainly, he was not in his best condition, as I felt he was carrying too much bulk. The legendary awesome thighs were way out of balance and not ripped enough. Also, his injured biceps was still noticeable. However, I feel that if Tom could have dropped the size of his thighs, resulting in a more ripped appearance while maintaining his upper body mass, I think he could have done much better. Certainly, he was one of the crowd's favorites. It'll be interesting to see where Tom goes from here. 9th, Bob Birdsong. This man never gives up. Birdsong is relentless in his pursuit of bodybuilding glory. Each contest, he just picks away ever so slowly and continues to come in top shape, improving on his last appearance. Today, it paid off with an impressive 9th place finish in a very heavy field of competition. I felt that Bob was in outstanding condition. Perhaps his condition was up there with the top three finishers in the entire event. The only thing I felt held him back was his posing. His routine was done to the music from the movie Ghostbusters. In an effort to come up with something different, Bob did too much dancing and not enough posing. He has an outstanding physique, and he should concentrate on showing it. 8th, Sergio Oliva. I've heard a great deal about this man over the years and could hardly wait to see him in person. He was named the myth, and with good reason. No other human being has been gifted with the superior genetics for bodybuilding like this man, who carries more muscle per square inch than any other human in history. As the myth made his entrance on stage, it was evident that everything said about him was fact. Now 50 years of age, Sergio was awesome with his gigantic arms and massive upper body, tapering down to that legendary tiny waist. This was Sergio's first Olympia in over 10 years, and because of a few bad breaks, his placing was questionable. Sergio was the crowd favorite, and he was the highlight of the competition. Unfortunately, Sergio drew the number one spot, which made him first to go on stage. This hurt his backstage preparations drastically, which had him unprepared and off balance during the entire prejudging. Unable to get his customary pump prior to the prejudging, I felt this hurt Sergio. If not physically, then definitely psychologically. In the evening competition, Sergio made sure he got his pump, and he looked sensational, bringing the enthusiastic New York audience to their feet. I definitely felt that Sergio should have been at least fifth or sixth in the final placing. We all hope he'll be back. Seventh was Bob Paris, a new face and definitely a man to watch in the future is the symmetrical and handsome Bob Paris. This was Bob's first Olympia appearance since winning last year's world championships in the heavyweight class. To place so high in his first Olympia, especially in a field of such champions, is quite an accomplishment. Paris has everything to make a name for himself in this sport. His posing is superb, graceful, and artistic. His symmetry is perfect, with long proportionate limbs, with plenty of room for extra muscle mass. The only thing Paris is lacking is time and a bit of maturity in his muscles. The man is a future great. Six, Samir Banout. Perhaps the biggest disappointment for me was to see last year's winner, Samir Banout, drop to sixth place. Samir was my pick to win the title again based on his excellent condition of 83. Ironically, his condition of 83 and 84 were unrelated. Today, Samir showed all the tremendous symmetry and huge proportions that he's famous for, but that old water problem that haunted him several years ago was back. The deep separation and blinding cuts that were so evident in Germany just were not there. Samir missed his timing, resulting in his less-than-best Mr. Olympia condition. Fifth, Roy Callender. At the 84 Olympia, one could call Roy Callender the sleeper of the competition. Certainly, Roy was in top condition, but it's been several years since we've seen him compete. All through the prejudging, Roy kept being called out for comparison poses. Most of us really did not consider Roy as a major threat to the top placings. However, when the final tally was counted, Roy was right in there for fifth place. Perhaps of all the 84 pros who were on the comeback trail, Roy was the only successful one. Roy has always had the muscle, and today he was cut and ripped, which is all the judges needed. The combination was enough to give him a most surprising placing. Fourth, Albert Beckles. It never ceases to amaze me how the eighth wonder of the world, Albert Beckles, continues to compete in sensational condition without showing any signs of aging. In fact, this is the highest that he's ever placed at the Olympia contest. It defies the imagination how a man of 54 can improve to the point of placing in the top four of the biggest bodybuilding competition in the world. In fact, so sharp and ripped was Albert that I would have placed him third ahead of Wilkosch. His condition was unbelievable, with a deep combination of size, density, and deep definition highlighted by the famous Beckles bicep. I have followed Albert's progress for many years now, and he just keeps getting better. 5 years ago, if you suggested that Albert could be a threat to the Olympia crown, you would have been laughed at. Now, that thought doesn't seem quite as humorous anymore, especially to the 16 other pros that Albert just defeated. Third, Joseph Wilkosch. Long overdue for a high placing, the hulking 240-pound German, Joseph Wilkosch, finally got what he's earned. For many years, his serious attempt at the Olympia has always been hindered by a painful knee injury, not to mention the constant criticism of his statue-like posing. Finally, Joseph put it all together, packing on so much additional size and thickness that the judges could not overlook him as he dwarfed the other smaller competitors. With a bit more in the legs, plus extra spirit in his posing, Josep could take the title next year in Belgium. Second, Mohamed Makawe. Mohamed wanted the Olympia with every essence of his being. He wanted to show the world that a small man could win the Olympia. Unfortunately, Lee Haney had other ideas. Literally starving himself to death the last month before the Olympia, Mohamed punished himself three times a day in the gym in order to give it his best shot. No one will argue the fact that Mohamed was not in top shape. He was sharper and more defined than last year and presented a totally new and outstanding posing routine. Everything pointed to the fact that Muhammad should have been declared the 1984 Mr. Olympia. However, no one counted on the incredible improvement of the hulking Lee Haney. Muhammad did his best, presenting a beautifully ripped, symmetrical, and aesthetic package of a perfect bodybuilder. How could anyone imagine the likes of Haney lurking in the wings to just dart on stage and snatch the Olympia title from the spirited and perky Magic Egyptian? First, Lee Haney. Gaining over 13 pounds of deep, thick, striated muscle since last year's Olympia, the gargantuan Haney literally destroyed everyone in winning his first Olympia. It was quite evident from the very minute that Lee walked on stage in the initial lineup that he was the winner. Just standing in the lineup of 20 pros, Lee stood out like Woody Allen at a bodybuilding convention. So thick were Lee's pecs and delts that he looked twice as wide as many of the others. Lee does not have the beautiful symmetry and shape of Muhammad, but when it comes to pure, unadulterated, thick slabs of muscle, Lee is unmatched. It's hard to describe in words just how much muscle this man packs on his 5'11" frame. His Olympia win found him weighing 245 pounds with less than 5% body fat. That alone is difficult to comprehend. Just being in the same room with Lee is intimidating because of his size. In my opinion, Lee won the 84 Olympia so easy that it was not even a contest. I also feel that Muhammad was equally as convincing a clear-cut winner for second place. Should Lee continue to compete and maintain his condition, he could win this title many times. As I stated earlier, Lee Haney is not just about muscles. He is a devoted family man with a beautiful wife, Shirley, constantly at his side. In fact, the first person Lee thanked upon winning the Olympia was God. He just dropped to his knees, placed his head down, and gave God thanks for the win. The next person he thanked was his wife, Shirley. In case anyone may have any ideas that Lee should not have won, let me lay this fact on you. In 1983, at the German Olympia in Munich, Lee came in weighing around 233 pounds ripped, where he placed second. Actually, he took third. This year, he came in weighing a ripped 245 pounds. That's a gain of over 10 pounds on an already Mr. Olympia physique. In appraising the other competitors, I found that none of the others accomplished this. Some came in more ripped at the same weight they were last year, such as Muhammad, but none were heavier while increasing their definition. Remember Lee Haney, the new myth. A legend has just been born in New York, November 3rd, 1984. All right. Yep, and Gary was right, because Lee went on to win the title 8 times and beat Arnold's record. So it definitely was a new era for bodybuilding. All right, guys, I got one more, and this should probably be the best one. This is from Rick Wayne, and it comes in the March 1985 issue of Flex Magazine. I might have read this on the podcast before, but I'm going to read it again because it's part of our 1984 Mr. Olympia report. The title says, "It's Haney Bug Swasher Extraordinaire," by Rick Wayne, photography by Mike Neveu and John Balick. Sergio's coming back. It started as a self-conscious whisper, barely audible above the hollow, pompous, puffy pitches of former lucky winners gone mad, returning retirees, whistlers in the dark, and sundry self-advertisers, not to mention fantasy mongers bored out of their tight little minds with the concept of ballet prancers as new heroes of the Olympia. Sergio's coming back. Through June, July, and August, the rumor survived, sustained by pessimistic thousands who for almost a decade had been saying that since Arnold's departure, the Big O, once 10 cuts above the rest, had transmogrified into a pathetic, toothless lion, all roar and no bite, a fantasy island farce for pretend gladiators and closet eaters of quiche. Ah, but some of us knew better than to swallow that Sergio line. We smiled our most inscrutable smiles, well acquainted as we were with the legend of the myth. Sergio coming back? No way. Since 1970 defeat by Arnold in New York, Sergio has made a career of castigating the IFBB and its founders. At nearly every turn, he flouted the Federation's laws. In London, he competed in an unsanctioned event against Bill Pearl, lost, and found himself suspended for 1 year by the IFBB. Then came his inexplicable defeat by Arnold in Germany. The victor credited the wall paint at the venue. After which, well, Sergio just seemed to lose touch with reality. 2 weeks before a scheduled 1974 Mr. Olympia appearance in New York, Sergio and Arnold collided in Tijuana. The result? A Mexican standoff so noisome that the IFBB later saw fit to suspend show promoter Eddie Sylvester and Arnold's tormentor for life. That was 73. Of course, that was hardly that. Soon after their South of the Border fandango, Sergio and Arnold crossed wrists again, this time refereed by Tom Snyder. Bodybuilding's two leading men went for each other's guts. Sergio swinging wildly with vicious intent, caring not one bit whose sensitive ego got in the way. Arnold deftly parrying, while millions of insomniac late-night TV addicts looked on incredulously. Naturally, the IFBB was outraged. One muscle builder barrage after another was fired in self-defense. And if the truth be told, Sergio caught a few in the rear. Safe behind their nom de plume, reckless scribes described him as, quote, a chicken without a head, unquote, and much worse. As I say, those of us who were not born yesterday and knew the full story of Sergio's rise and fall paid scant attention to the comeback story. A long time ago, we had convinced ourselves that the IFBB had seen the last of Sergio Oliva. The official word set us right. Sergio had publicly announced his intention to compete in the 84 Mr. Olympia, scheduled for November 3rd at the Felt Forum, New York. In its usual democratic fashion, the IFBB had decided to first consult loyal supporters, including regular Mr. Olympia contenders, on the question of the prodigal son's return to the fold. Sergio's IFBB future would depend on the majority vote. World Gym's Joe Gold, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Armad Tani, and several of the confirmed 84 Mr. Olympia contestants received letters soliciting their vote on the Sergio matter. Gold expressed regret that there had been need to keep one of bodybuilding's greatest superheroes out of the IFBB picture, even for 1 minute, let alone 11 years. Arnold agreed, as indeed did the canvas contestants, all except Bertel Fox, who insisted that Sergio be forced to pay the price of his disloyalty over the years. Not that the thought of facing Sergio in New York bothered Bertel. After all, he had gone up against Sergio once before in Paris. And even though Bertel had been forced to eat crow on that occasion, that didn't mean he was scared witless by the thought of a second encounter. Of course not. Fox was no chicken. Samir Benoot, who won the 83 Mr. Olympia, showed no signs of fear. Somehow he remained calm when someone suggested that Samir's ambition to win the title in 84 and four more times thereafter was in danger now that Sergio had apparently re-entered the Mr. Olympia picture. Averred Samir, if Sergio comes in as big and cut as when he faced Arnold in Essen, then it's all over for everyone else in New York. Of course, Samir didn't for 1 minute believe that anyone could at age 50-something pull off such a feat, not even Sergio. In September, Wayne D'Amelio, who with New York gym owner and longtime IFBB booster Julie Levine would produce the 84 Mr. Olympia, taped for the December issue of this magazine an interview with Sergio. The star interviewee confirmed that, yes, he would be among the contenders on November 3rd. Why? Well, past problems with the IFBB notwithstanding, bodybuilding had remained his first love. The fans had never stopped clamoring for his return. And since his physique was now in better shape than it had been 10 years earlier, he figured, what the heck? 1984 is as good a time as any to reclaim my Mr. Olympia title. Besides, there was a little matter of the prize money, $100,000. Three Mr. Olympia victories in 1967, 68, and 69 had brought Sergio the grand sum of $3,000. If he won in 84, he would take home almost 20 times that amount. Oh, yes, indeed. A big if, but one most definitely worth gambling on. Between sets at World's Gym, a transformed 255-pound Lee Haney read Sergio's short interview and smiled. 2 weeks earlier at Weider headquarters in Woodland Hills, Lee had aimed a banana-sized forefinger at a visiting Samir Benoot and growled, "See that little bug? I'm going to squash him in New York." And the incumbent hero had shied away in disbelief. Now at World Gym, it seemed the last thing Lee wanted to do was squash anybody. When someone asked what he thought about Sergio's comeback decision, Lee just shook his head and without one word went back to work on the heavy-duty lap machine. You got the feeling right then that come November 3rd, Lee would do what he had to be done in New York, but there'd be no joy in that undoing. I tried to communicate with Sergio on the matter of his resurrection. Oh, many times. He proved beyond reach. Said his wife, Arlene, "Sergio's asleep," or "You just missed him," or "I'll tell him you called. Maybe he'll call back." And of course, he didn't. Arlene assured me that her husband was doing fine, never mind the pictures in Bob Kennedy's muscle mag that suggested Sergio had turned into a 260-pound butterball. Was Sergio perturbed by the stories concerning Lee Haney, Casey Viator, Bertel Fox, Chuck Williams, ostensibly among the leading lights in the 84 Mr. Olympia? Certainly not. Au contraire, Sergio fully anticipated a triumphant return. I formed the opinion that my old friend no longer wished to confide in me, that he no longer trusted me. After all, more than 5 years had passed since our last meeting. What's more, I had for several years been close to the Weider organization. How could Sergio know for certain what I had caught? Meanwhile, Bertel Fox had split. He escaped to friendly territory, far away from California, World Gym, and Golds, where such opposition dragons as Lee Haney, Tom Platz, Samir Banute, and Bob Paris made the atmosphere unbearable. A big fish at home only in small ponds, Bertel had fled to Germany, where 1 year earlier he prepared for his second Mr. Olympia assault. Germany, where he had friends genuine enough to have stood up and booed for close to 5 minutes at the announcement that all their hero had managed was fifth place. Moreover, Bertel had learned not to trust himself on home ground. In California, contest be damned, he tended to succumb to the excessive dictates of his notoriously indiscriminate appetite. In Germany, on the other hand, he was constantly surrounded by sycophants who worshipped the ground he sweated on. Opportunities to pig out were almost non-existent. Circumstances forced him to stick with his pre-contest diet. Bertel's 1984 plan was to train away from home until 3 days before the Mr. Olympia and then move to New York, where Kim awaited with home comforts. Ah, but the plan went awry. 3 weeks before the contest, Bertel sneaked back to L.A., by all accounts, a changed man. Sighter swore that he couldn't have weighed more than 180 pounds, that now Bertel was but a shadow of the man he'd been when he left for Germany, the man who had weighed 240-something. What diabolical regimen could he have endured in Deutschland? What suicidal masochism? He took no phone calls. Investigators were told by Kim that her husband was awaiting the results of medical tests before deciding whether or not to show his now ferret face in New York. Yes, yes, with less than 2 weeks before the 84 Mr. Olympia, the one that Bertel had sworn to win. Well, catastrophe. The ritual meeting of the IFBB judges and contestants on the eve of the Mr. Olympia started promptly at 7:30 p.m. according to schedule on the second floor of the Doral Inn on Lexington Avenue. I arrived a quarter of an hour late, as was duly noted by Hawkeye Ben Weider, with Lee Haney in tow. Little did the IFBB president know that his speech was being taped, that in my own time I would refer to all that was said in my absence. Nevertheless, I was in time to hear Ben say, "I know that this contest represents a critical part in the life of the professional bodybuilders who are here this evening. The IFBB has taken every precaution to select the judges with utmost care and attention and consideration to assure that everyone gets justice, fair judging, and no favoritism based on stupidity." He said that the IFBB had spared no expense to ensure impartiality. Wayne D'Amelio had been mandated to verify and scrutinize every round of the judging. There would be seven judges and two alternates. Any judge found wanting would be immediately removed from the Mr. Olympia panel and replaced by an alternate. Naturally, after the contest, there would be some disappointed people, but they would not be able to blame their disappointment on the IFBB. After all, the IFBB had spared no effort and expense in the search for the most experienced and competent judges. Ben Weider assured everyone present that it makes no difference to my brother Joe and me who wins tomorrow night. As he had done several times at similar occasions, he pointed out that it was literally impossible to fix the Mr. Olympia or any other IFBB event. At the conclusion of his speech, the president of the IFBB called on the contestants to express any disagreement with the choice of judges. Nobody spoke up. The meeting was over. Bob Paris, Samir Banute, Charles Glass, Chuck Williams, Bob Birdsong, Robbie Robinson, Hubert Metz, Appy Steenbeck, Bill Grant, Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, Yosef Wilkosch, Lee Haney, Tony Pearson, and Mohamed Makawe took turns dipping for the numbers that would establish the order of appearance on the next day's event. Sergio was the last to dip, and he came up with the number one. "God," he grimaced, "that means I'm going to be the first on stage. Mama." I reminded him that twice Frank Zane had picked number one, and each time he'd been declared Mr. Olympia. "Ah," said Sergio, smiling. He'd been the first, after Ben Weider, to acknowledge my presence on the second floor of the Doral Inn. He'd offered his hand and suggested we talk after the meeting. Finally, it was as if nothing had changed. We hugged. I felt his enormous deltoids and arms through the thin fabric of his gym jacket. Wished him luck. He said he was in better shape than ever before, better than he'd been for his last outing against Arnold, when nearly everyone said Sergio was out of this world. And maybe because he caught something in my eyes, a little doubt perhaps, pulled me aside, lifted the front of his jacket, just high enough to expose his midriff. "Check this out," he said, pointing to his flexed abdominals. Veins and cuts popped up everywhere. Franco Colombo joined us and noted with discernible relief that the butterball of Bob Kennedy's magazine was now a lean, mean contest machine. "Everybody say I'm going to come like this," said Sergio. He puffed out his cheeks so that he took on the appearance of a blowfish. "Tomorrow they're going to see. I'm going to stop them all." He said he weighed about 240 pounds, a slight exaggeration, it seemed to me. The old Sergio, which is to say the young, unstoppable Sergio, had weighed 225 pounds, yet was bigger and taller than this bespectacled, bald 84 version. On the other hand, it was true that what appeared gigantic to the eye of a child then tended to shrink before adult inspection. We were recalling good times past, glorious times, when Joe Weider intervened. He shook Sergio's hand and whispered in his ear, "Sergio, you know I've always loved you. Like you. Ask Ricky." On the fifth floor of the Doral Inn, Roy Callender was in bed watching TV. His wife Maggie took me up to their room. Roy lets us in. He had on a white woolen sweats and socks under a tan trench coat. He appeared much larger than he'd been at the 81 Olympia, after which he'd given up his Montreal abode and returned to his native Barbados. But facially, Roy looked like death warmed over. When he smiled, you could almost hear his parched lips creaking under the strain, like some heavy cobweb door slowly opening on rusty hinges. I made small talk, inquired about life in Barbados, local politics, his brand new gym. He said the resort island was fine for those who had learned to enjoy clean air, sea, and sunshine without money. He had a good job at the Ministry of Sport, but it meant having to work with politicians who were, well, like politicians the world over. The best part of having his own gym was the privacy it offered. In recent months, he'd given up training in the evening. His customers made it difficult for him to concentrate on his contest preparations. He'd taken to training early in the morning, from 4 to 7 daily, packing into 3 hours more work than he'd previously done in 6. And he'd come close to killing himself. Several times he thought he might crack. But Roy had persevered. He learned to live with bone-crushing, nerve-wracking torture, and in the process discovered something. Something deep inside himself that Roy never knew was there. Roy didn't quite know how to describe it, not without sounding like a fool, but hell, Roy was pretty certain that what he discovered in himself was God. Yes, God. He regretted that he not had much exposure in the magazines of late. His fault. He should have kept in touch. And now worried that he might pay the price the next day. Bodybuilding fans were so fickle, they forgot so quickly. He had missed Ben Weider's meeting on the second floor of the Doral Inn, but not deliberately. No one had seen fit to notify Roy, which in retrospect seems odd, for it was at Ben's meeting that I encountered Maggie. She said she spied Mohamed Makawe downstairs, and he certainly didn't look ready for a contest. Admittedly, at the time, Makawe was fully dressed. Roy expressed concern about Sergio. Would the judges treat him as just another contender, or would they succumb to the legend of the myth? Something like that had occurred at the Sydney Opera House when Arnold made his last Mr. Olympia bid. The goddamn judges looked at the nervous man who stood before them, but they saw only the glorious ghost of Arnold past. "So it was," said Roy, "that a below-par 1980 Arnold walked away with his 7th Mr. Olympia title." No wonder Roy was depressed. Back in Los Angeles, Lou Ferrigno had promised me that if Sergio Oliva showed up in New York looking half as miraculous as he'd been in Essen 11 years before, there'd be no stopping him. Now, 2 months later, in the packed lobby of the Doral Inn, amid stampeding autograph hunters, popping flashbulbs, and regular New York insanities, I finally cornered him. "Say, Lou," I said, "what you think now?" He smiled like a little boy with a naughty secret. "I saw him," he said. And I said, "So?" And he said, "Did you see his cheekbones? He's got to be cut under that jacket." And I said, "Did you see Haney?" And he said, "I still say Sergio can pull it off." He raised his eyes. "Oh, God, I hope so." Lou first met Oliva in 1969 at the Academy of Music, minutes after he won his last Mr. Olympia. Lou was just 17 then, but already a lifetime member of the Oliva cult. 15 years later, he couldn't bring himself to entertain the possibility of Sergio's defeat, not against the likes of such mortals as Samir Banood and Muhammad Mukawe. Even to the Incredible Hulk, some things remain sacred forever. Wayne D'Amelio had traveled a long way since erstwhile East Coast IFBB representative Tom Minichiello handed him his first big break, the opportunity to stage the 1975 Mr. Eastern America in New York. The show was an unqualified hit. It earned its promoter more money than Arnold had received for winning the year's Mr. Olympia. Moreover, it convinced D'Amelio that a man did not necessarily have to sweat for his bread and butter. He could promote while others did the sweating. Shortly after his highly publicized successful debut, D'Amelio was summoned to IFBB headquarters in Montreal. Several IFBB show organizers had written to their president expressing gratitude for services rendered by D'Amelio. It seems that long before his New York contest, D'Amelio and his wife Karen had been in the habit of traveling to muscle expos all over the East Coast to lend a hand backstage or wherever else help was needed. They had carved for themselves an enviable reputation among the leading IFBB promoters and contestants, and acquired on-the-job training that in due course would prove invaluable. Ben Weider had always been quick to recognize initiative. He welcomed D'Amelio, placed him on the IFBB's professional bodybuilding committee. When Tom Minichiello fell out of favor with the IFBB, D'Amelio neatly slipped in to replace him. In 1978, the new favorite staged his first Night of the Champions event at New York's Town Hall. It sold out, having attracted some of the hottest pro bodybuilding names, including Robbie Robinson, who won the main prize of $10,000. Within days of the contest, D'Amelio was receiving from all over the country requests for tickets to his next night. His fame spread. He staged contests in Pittsburgh, Miami, California, and New Orleans, some highly successful, some not. But New York never let him down. Here he put on his Night of the Champions for five consecutive years, always at a nice profit. He found himself in great demand. On behalf of the IFBB, he traveled to Australia, Egypt, the Philippines, Germany, Brussels, and London. Toward the end of 1982, D'Amelio took a call from his buddy, Julie Levine. To the best of D'Amelio's recollection, Julie said he had a friend, someone he'd known a long time, who trained at his gym in Brooklyn, whose name was Eddie, who was a millionaire. By D'Amelio's account, Levine said Eddie was prepared to put up the money to stage the 84 Mr. Olympia in New York on condition D'Amelio didn't mind taking Eddie and Julie on as partners. Eddie wanted 50% of the profits. Julie and D'Amelio would share equally whatever was left. For years, D'Amelio had dreamed of staging the Olympia in his hometown, but he wanted to do it the right way. He wanted to offer a larger purse than had ever been paid before, much more than D'Amelio could get his hands on. Until Julie's call, that is. A meeting was arranged. Eddie would lay out all the money. He had connections who would jump at the opportunity to participate in the Mr. Olympia venture. D'Amelio wouldn't have to invest 1 cent. The whole thing sounded too good to be true. In January 1983, the president of the IFBB received a proposal from Eddie. If his bid for the 84 Olympia was acceptable, he would guarantee the largest purse ever offered, $100,000. The IFBB would receive $25,000 in sanction fees, $5,000 upon the formal acceptance of the bid, the remaining $20,000 within 30 days of the contest. The promoters would, as required by IFBB rules, pay air transportation for all invited contenders, 7 judges, and 1 alternate. Contenders would be given free hotel accommodation and an allowance of $35 for meals. Mr. and Mrs. Ben Weider would be provided first-class air transportation, first-class hotel accommodation, and meals during the contest weekend in New York. Not long after his letter to Ben Weider, Eddie deposited in a New York account in the name of the IFBB $100,000. Then he turned to Wayne D'Amelio with a special request. As D'Amelio remembers, he asked me to do whatever was possible to get Sergio Oliva to compete in the 84 Mr. Olympia. He said Sergio had always been his idol. Unfortunately, D'Amelio had never met Sergio. No matter, having received word that their query was making guest appearances at a contest in Albany, New York, D'Amelio and Levine set out to accomplish a mission impossible. 11 years had passed since Sergio's last IFBB adventure. By everything he told reporters, it was clear that he was still at war with the federation that had banished him for life. During the intermission, D'Amelio was introduced to Sergio. The promoter's account: The minute he heard of my connection with the IFBB, Oliva turned sour. "No, no," he said, spreading his hands over his face. "I don't want to talk about the IFBB or Weider or nothing like that. They screw me in New York. They screw me in Germany. They screw me all over. The same tired old story that everyone heard a million times." So Levine played his card. "Sergio," he said, "don't you remember me?" Back in the 60s, before Sergio took up bodybuilding full-time, they had competed for AAU weightlifting trophies. They'd been friends. Sergio stared for a moment, and suddenly his face lit up. "Oh, my God, I don't recognize you, baby. My man, Julie." They embraced, and while D'Amelio looked on, Levine explained their predicament. He and his friend Wayne had contracted to stage the 84 Mr. Olympia at the Feld Forum. The big problem was that their millionaire backer, who worshipped Oliva, was insisting on his return. Chances were that if Sergio refused to compete, the millionaire fan would pull out of the deal. Still, Sergio didn't want to know. But Levine persisted. He said the IFBB was now a different organization from what Sergio remembered. The old horses had either died or disappeared. Joe Weider took no part in contest decisions. Judges were selected by the IFBB's special committee. Sergio promised to give the matter serious consideration. In the months that followed, the three men communicated by telephone. It was no easy job getting Sergio to let go of the past. For more than a decade, he'd held fast to the belief that Joe Weider had been behind his fall from prominence. Excising the notion from his mind had to be equal to the do-it-yourself lobotomy. No one knows for certain what finally turned Sergio around. Maybe it had something to do with the Mr. Olympia prize money. $50,000 was more than Patrolman Oliva could earn in 2 years. A baby was on the way. The money would certainly come in handy. Almost 1 year after D'Amelio and Levine first talked about their joint promotion and their Mission Impossible, they reported back to their millionaire backer. The tiger was in the bag. Sergio had agreed to compete in his first IFBB event in over a decade. He even agreed to be interviewed for Weider's newest magazine, Flex. What a coup. Shortly after the Oliva story appeared in print, the promoters of the 84 Mr. Olympia made another important public announcement. The 5,000-seat Feld Forum had sold out. Everyone had good reason to celebrate. The Garden was hardly foreign territory. It had been the venue for the IFBB's 10th Mr. Olympia, when a still-hungry Arnold had taken the opportunity to not only put an overambitious Lou Ferrigno in his place, but also to serve notice on all dreamers that for as long as he damn well pleased, the Big O would remain his personal property. Frank Zane had good reason to remember. In 1974, when the Mr. Olympia was wrapped up in class distinction, he had come ever so close to winning the under 200-pound division. The decision had gone to Arnold's cocky sidekick, Franco Colombo. And after all those years, that had been for Frank an unsolvable puzzlement. Of course, one dumb decision did not a loser make. Frank had gone on to win the Big O on three consecutive occasions, a record that in the 19-year history of the contest had been attained only by two other men. One was in Italy filming his next moneymaker, and the other, after an 11-year absence, would on this day, November 3rd, 1984, try for his fourth Mr. Olympia victory. Percipient devil that he is, Frank had chosen this year to stay out of the affray. For a nice fat fee, Frank Zane had allowed NBC to talk him into making like Frank Gifford. While the 84 Mr. Olympia contender sweated with hope, Frank would enthrall TV viewers with his educated eye view of the IFBB's most important event. Bruno, the Garden's chief security officer, also remembered the 74 Mr. Olympia. He'd been on duty that night. "Now at 8 a.m., with the New York atmosphere determined to keep sunny California on my mind, all Bruno wanted to talk about was how Arnold and Lou had both done bodybuilding proud and were destined to become major movie stars and multimillionaires. From Bruno's point of view, the two former Mr. Olympia campaigners were further proof that bodybuilders weren't dumb, at any rate, no more so than politicians, for instance. Bruno regretted that Red Sonja was keeping Arnold in Italy, that he wouldn't be attending the 84 Mr. Olympia. Bruno had set his heart on seeing Arnold again. Still, there was consolation in the fact that Lou Ferrigno, Frank Zane, and Franco Colombo would all be present. Among other early birds at the forum were promoters Wayne D'Amelio and Julie Levine, their wives Karen and Sandy, Frank and Christine Zane, and an NBC camera crew. While D'Amelio supervised the lighting arrangement and the hoisting of the new Mr. Olympia banner, it cost the promoters $1,200. Elsewhere in the theater, the Levines did their best to cope with last-minute demands for non-existent tickets. Over the gabble of cleaning ladies and electricians, I overheard this conversation between an NBC producer and Wayne D'Amelio. Wayne, will you please tell us before the announcement, who are the winners? Why? Because I'd like to focus on the faces of the losers. D'Amelio promised to do his best. Another time, the producer wanted D'Amelio to indicate wives and girlfriends of the various contenders. Why? Asked the promoter. Because I want to show the strain of elation on their faces as the men perform on stage. D'Amelio said he didn't think it was such a good idea. Why? Asked the producer. Because you never know who has a wife at home while his girlfriend is at the show. The Mr. Olympia preliminaries were scheduled for 2 p.m. The evening performance would begin at 8 p.m. At 1 p.m., Julie Levine left the forum in a huge bus to pick up the contenders at the Doral Inn. I went along for the ride, perchance to catch some interesting conversation. Strictly in the line of duty, of course. Boyer Coe talked about his short-lived career with Nautilus, the exercise equipment manufacturers. Others spoke longingly of favorite dishes resisted in the interest of Mr. Olympia ambitions. Will contenders please line up? We're on in 5 minutes. The first of several calls came at 1:45. The appeals fell on unhearing ears. Outside one dressing room, Mrs. Robbie Robinson stood guard while her husband meditated, fully dressed, inside, his flat-top Carl Lewis haircut the most striking aspect of his appearance. 2 weeks earlier, Franco Colombo had predicted that Robbie would be the surprise of the 84 Olympia. I could barely wait for the unveiling. Mohammed McAway, by now a Mr. Olympia veteran, occupied two chairs, one for regular service, the other for his feet. If a cool demeanor meant a man had no worries, then McAway had to be in seventh heaven. On the other hand, the face of James Gobert suggested first-degree depression. Sergio Oliva was his old self, carrying on about the short time available for pumping up when he needed at least an hour, evoking memories of bizarre dressing room scenes from his glorious heyday. Another anachronistic in his new setting. He grabbed a barbell and, well attired in his blue sweatsuit, did a series of bent-over rows. Nearby, a Michael Jackson Tony Pearson was anointing himself in Johnson's baby oil. Observing him, Tony said, "Hey, Rick, thanks for all the magazine publicity." His eyes begging for approval, he pointed to his tensed right thigh at the precise moment that Sergio chose to look up and said, "I'm ready. I'm going to eat them like candy." "Great," I said automatically. You do not contradict a man's nurtured opinion of himself, not minutes before the toughest challenge to his manhood. Sergio grunted, brushed past Tony, and ordered me to follow him to a nearby toilet, where he unceremoniously dropped his sweatpants and growled, "He talk about candy. I show him candy." "Wow," I exclaimed, my enthusiasm mechanism still on automatic. Actually, I was thinking that even as though they were still amazing, Sergio's thighs were no longer the carved ebony pillars that 16 years earlier had brought tears to Arnold's eyes. "Last call. Anyone not on stage in 2 seconds will be disqualified." The line had never failed to get attention. I dashed toward the dressing room exit past a wild-eyed Samir Banoot, who took the opportunity to shrink "pencil neck" in my ear, friends we hadn't been of late. Desperate to get to my seat, I made it just in time to hear the announcer say, "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the greatest bodybuilding event in 19 years. Our first Mr. Olympia contestant is Sergio Oliva." Of course, New York, the city that made Oliva, where the whole Mr. Olympia idea first took root and blossomed, was eager to pay homage to its creations. Naturally, the packed house exploded at the sound of his name. Sergio received his first standing ovation, even before he'd actually stepped on stage. Poor Samir walked right into the noise. Bill Grant and Bob Birdsong, too. Tom Platz was next, and New York accorded him the same warm reception that Tom had received in London in 82 and in Germany the following year. Never mind that there he was only a guest poser at the Mr. Olympia. Nice guys do not always finish last. Albert Beckles took the noise somewhat decibels higher and was followed by Robbie Robinson, Bob Paris, Chris Dickerson, Tony Pearson, Chuck Williams, Appy Steenbeck, and Hubert Metz, all of whom received warm applause. With the appearance of Josip Wilkos, the atmosphere heated up again. Roy Callender stoked the fire, as did Boyer Coe, Lee Haney, and Mohammed McAway. Charles Glass and James Gobert followed them to complete the semicircle around the posing platform. So now you want to know, was the 84 Mr. Olympia lineup truly the greatest ever? On paper, perhaps, After all, it boosted three former Mr. Olympia winners, Oliva, Dickerson, and Benoit, none of whom was in the shape that had won him special distinction. Where I'm concerned, Sergio's special contribution to the event had little to do with his physique. The audience, and I, would have been happy to see him again if he'd chosen only to make a guest appearance. He didn't have to put his invincibility on the line. If he needed money, he could have chosen to make his peace with the IFBB and then let it be known that he was available for exhibitions. IFBB promoters everywhere would have welcomed him. The fans would have eaten him up. He'd have earned a small fortune over the next 2 years, especially if he'd taken the time to whip himself into regular Oliva shape. In New York, he was not quite as tempered as he'd been at his last Mr. Olympia adventure. 6 more weeks of serious preparation would have rendered him unbeatable at the Forum, where Sergio displayed what was still very much a young man's physique. The lines were in his face only, more of a consequence of Spartan diets than age, as Frank Zane, Franco Colombo, and Arnold Schwarzenegger can attest to. What we saw at the Forum was a not quite contest-ready Oliva. He may have underestimated the competition. After all, who could have anticipated the transformed Lee Haney? Never before had a physique contestant so easily outclassed his opposition. Not only were Lee's best body parts, back, chest, thighs, waist, better than ever, previously weak areas were now in harmony with the rest of his incredible body. From the moment Haney stepped on stage, it was clear that Chris Dickerson's ambition, Samir's too, of course, of winning the Big O more than once was nothing more than a pipe dream, in 1984 at any rate. Tom Platz was also marked for disappointment. Bob Paris was impressive. Those who say he lacked mass, he weighed close to 240 pounds at around 6 feet, might be interested in something Steve Reeves once told me. People are forever asking what I might have developed into had I continued to train for contests past the age of 23. I certainly would have allowed myself to grow bigger. I believe that a structure can take on only so much mass before it loses its symmetry and becomes grotesque. I'd have developed more cuts, but that's all. Perhaps Paris, who has often been likened to Reeves, has similar ideas. One thing for certain, in all of bodybuilding, there isn't a more beautifully structured physique. It remains to be seen whether or not this post-Michelangelo David changes into Goliath for future Mr. Olympia raids. Chuck Williams and Charles Glass had been phenomenal when they won their divisions in the 83 American Bodybuilding Championships in New York. They showed none of the cuts that had made them such hits in San Jose, nor the muscle mass for that matter. Tony Pearson is always beautiful, but Mr. Olympia material he is not. Not at this juncture. And the least said about James Gobert, the hit of the 82 American Championships, the better. As noted earlier, Franco Colombo had warned me to expect a Robbie Robinson Mr. Olympia victory. I suspected at the time that Franco had chosen to bet, no money was involved, of course, on Robbie because the 76 and 81 Mr. Olympia winner couldn't bring himself to bet on Tom Platz and others who made life rough for him at the last Mr. Olympia bid. Of course, Franco insisted that wasn't the case, that in fact he'd seen Robbie in training and he couldn't believe the shape he was in. In New York, Robbie was pathetic. Albert Beckles was, of course, tremendous, as was Bob Birdsong. But Bill Grant missed the boat along with the Germans, Appy Steenbeck and Hubert Metz. Fellow countryman Josef Wilkosch, on the other hand, was stupendous. Boyerko? Suffice it to say that he'd improved on his best parts, which underscored inferior characteristics. Roy Callender was still depressed. Indeed, his skin appeared to have changed overnight from coal black to ash gray. Which brings us to Mohamed Makawe, probably the smallest man in the event. Of course, that had long ceased to work against the Egyptian. He had a special knack for bringing giants to their knees. In his time, he'd wiped out the likes of Lee Haney, Boyer Coe, Casey Viator, and Albert Beckles. It seemed to me that in New York, Makawe was not nearly as sharp as he'd been in London and Germany. But then, what did that matter when 75% of the 84 Mr. Olympia lineup were not at their best? Does all of this suggest a thrill-free contest? If so, forgive me. The Mr. Olympia preliminaries were not without an exciting moment or two. There was that time when a sweating Sergio suddenly descended from the posing platform, walked toward the judging panel, and then wham, 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 cranked out three most muscular poses that seemed to fill the theater, to the ecstatic delight of fans and other contenders. And of course, there were Lee Haney's breathtaking displays of insuperable Mr. Olympia artillery. The preliminaries ended around 5 p.m. Backstage, I eavesdropped as Frank Zane gingerly interviewed Sergio on camera. Earlier, Frank had asked me when I thought would be the most appropriate time to talk to Sergio. Bearing in mind the possible result of the contest, I advised Frank to catch him before the evening performance. "Why did you come back?" asked the interviewer. "Because," said Sergio, sweat pouring down his forehead into his eyes, "I am in the greatest shape of my life." Zane had been one of the contenders in the 1972 Mr. Olympia, when Sergio was indeed at his best. He chose not to contradict the dreamer. Instead, he asked, "How much longer can you go on?" Sergio explained what Zane already knew, that a man took good care of himself, he could go on competing almost indefinitely, maybe until he was 60. "And I'm not even 45, said Sergio. "I'm 43. In the evening, another full house turned out to see the most predictable Mr. Olympia since 1968, when no one had showed up to challenge Oliva. Midway through Ben Weider's welcome speech, the crowd suddenly erupted, drowning out the IFBB president. Lou Ferrigno and his father, Matt, had just made their grand entrance. Ben waited for the commotion to subside. It didn't. How could it, with Lou throwing double bicep shots all over the place? Finally, the presidential voice sounded, "Please, Lou, sit down so we can get on." When Ben resumed, he said, "Actually, this Mr. Olympia is going to be the battle of the giants. The majority are in top shape. There can only be one winner. We went out of our way to pick seven of the world's best judges. They come from Belgium, Canada, USA, Czechoslovakia, Singapore, Germany, and Holland. We spent a lot of money to bring you the finest judges in the IFBB." The audience applauded when Ben reminded them that the Mr. Olympia purse had grown from a measly $1,000 to $100,000. Moreover, that in 1985, there'd be even more money for Mr. Olympia winners. "We have one small disappointment," Ben said. "Bertle Fox didn't make it." When the crowd booed, Ben explained that the IFBB had received a letter from Bertle and a certificate from his physician explaining Bertle's absence. "The poor fellow has a bad back," said Ben. "Chicken!" roared a group of doubting Thomases. In due course, Ben Weider received a special award for his contributions to bodybuilding, as did his brother Joe. Wayne D'Amelio also received a plaque for his efforts. And then it was on with the show. Actually, it amounted to this. Each contestant went through his posing routine to the recorded music of his choice. As before, Sergio was first on stage. Nothing fancy here, just a series of house-breaking, most muscular shots, the famous arms-overhead pose, still mind-boggling after all these years, and the Oliva double biceps. But enough to earn Sergio his third or fourth standing ovation. Oh, yes. Again, Samir ran into the tail end of Sergio's exhaust. But in all fairness, I should add that Samir was better during the evening performance than he'd been earlier. That is, during the afternoon preliminaries, he was even less muscular. Albert Beckles and Bob Birdsong posed to disco beats. That Albert got away with it was due only to the amazing amount of muscle he carried around the stage. Birdsong was another story. His was the silliest display I've ever witnessed at a physique show. Lee Haney had obviously not come out to fool around. He posed like a professional and brought the house down. As always, Makawe was in a class all his own. When this Egyptian gets going, Macho Man drops his guard and is in danger of becoming an appreciator of La Belle. You actually found yourself wondering what if Haney had done would be enough to keep Makawe at bay. Such a fine poser is he. Bill Grant didn't make the finals. Neither did Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, Robbie Robinson, Chuck Williams, Appy Steenbeck, Hubert Metz, Charles Glass, or James Gobert. So having cleared the stage, Wayne D'Amelio brought on the heavies. Sergio Oliva, Samir Banut, Bob Birdsong, Tom Platz, Albert Beckles, Bob Paris, Yosef Wilkosh, Roy Callender, Lee Haney, and Mohamed Makawe. Now it was time for the excuse for chaos that passes for a pose down. "Haney," shouted 90% of the rioters. "Sergio," others hollered. A barefaced few rooted for Samir. "Show him what you got," screamed an altogether loyal Lisa, Albert's true love. "Go, Lee," squirreled Shirley Haney. "Go, Haney." 2 years earlier, her husband had given her the American Bodybuilding Championships as a first wedding anniversary present. Now he planned to give her the whole ball of wax as a birthday gift. Not even the love that Lisa held for Albert could compare with Lee's devotion to Shirley. At last, the final result. In 10th place, Bob Birdsong. Birdsong accepted his check for $1,000 with a face that wasn't worth a nickel. In 9th place, Tom Platz. He took his money with all the grace he could muster. In eighth place, it seemed that D'Amelio had suddenly lost his voice. His eyes opened wide. His lips moved, but no sound left his throat. Then, with a determined look, he blurted out, "Sergio Oliva." "Boo!" The house was in an uproar. But Sergio, famous for his short temper, kept his cool. Or so it seemed, initially. Sergio's face tightened suddenly, and now I knew that a time bomb was ticking away in his head that at any moment would explode. I saw him take a deep breath and brace myself for the worst. Then I found myself running toward the stage, shouting desperately, "Cool it, Sergio. Let it go. Keep your head." From the corner of my eye, I spied Arlene Oliva coming down the aisle, headed toward the backstage area, the four-week-old Oliva baby in her arms. "Give him to me, Arlene, please," I pleaded. "Let Sergio show him off to the audience." And she did. Arlene let me take her baby, and I passed him on to his father. "Sergio," I screamed. "Here, take him. Go to the lectern. Make a good speech, a thank you speech." Through all that, the crowd continued to boo. Sergio looked down at me, a dazed look in his eyes. Then, to my relief, he bent down and picked up baby Sergio, held him aloft, and headed toward the mic. "A good speech, Sergio," I called out again. Oh, he was magnificent. He thanked the now silent audience, thanked all who had rooted for him, who had remained faithful for nearly 20 years. A wonderful speech. Afterward, Wayne D'Amelio continued with his announcements. Bob Paris, Samir Benoot, Roy Callender, and Albert Beckles took 7th, $2,000, 6th, $2,500, 5th, $4,000, and 4th, $6,000, respectively. In third place, D'Amelio went on, Yosef Wilkosh. He gets $10,000. The audience held its breath for the next all-important announcement. After all, at muscle contests, anything can happen. In second place, the announcer paused for effect. Mohamed Makawe. It was pointless making the final announcement, but D'Amelio did anyway. Mr. Olympia, 1984, Lee Haney. There had never been a more popular decision. Lee picked up his check for $50,000, and then he posed for the ritual pictures, posed, 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 then signaled to Shirley, who came bounding from the wings. Together, they approached the mic. Lee thanked the audience for their support, and then he said, "It's been a great night for Shirley and me. I have achieved my dream, but I also want to say that meeting Sergio Oliva will remain one of the highlights of my life." Indeed, throughout the contest, Lee had treated Oliva with reverence. Sergio was hardly a threat on this occasion, and Lee saw no reason to parade over him. He did what he had to do and no more, unlike some who ended up losers anyway. My most memorable moment came when Sergio, baby in hand, said, "No matter what happened tonight, 8th, 17th, or 20th, I forever be the myth. And I hold in my arm Sergio Jr., the next myth." It was the first time Sergio had ever used the sobriquet in my presence. I had given it to him on our first meeting in 1967. On the night of November 3rd, 1984, it seemed to me that no one better deserved the nickname. And so ended the IFBB's 19th Mr. Olympia. All that remained was the postmortem. The end. Written as only Rick Wayne can write it. That was really a great article. Definitely different than the other articles. Rick kind of wrote the backstage part of it, and it was great hearing his role in getting Sergio to go to the mic and hold the baby on stage. And that was 40 years ago. So Sergio Jr. is now 40 years old. Unbelievable. And Sergio Sr., of course, has long passed away. I think Sergio's been passed away for over 10 years now. But wow, what an amazing contest. I mean, there's not going to be another Mr. Olympia like that ever again, I think. You know, it's just full of drama and excitement. I wasn't there, but I saw the video of the contest, and the crowds were just going absolutely crazy. The atmosphere had to be unbelievable. And it's just not quite as exciting this year or any other year anymore. Just those shows back in the 70s and 80s really had a magic to them. And it was Lee Haney's first Mr. Olympia. And as Rick said and other articles said, Lee was just so dominating. And what really made this contest in 84 so unique, I think, was that they had all those older school bodybuilders like Chris Dickerson and Boyer Coe and Bill Grant and all these other guys that came from the 70s, really. And they were pretty much on their way out. Chris Dickerson won the Olympia 2 years earlier and couldn't even make top 10. That's unbelievable. 2 years. You went from Mr. Olympia winner to not even being in the top 10. And then you had all the new guys coming in. And it was interesting how they were talking about Bob Parris and that quote from Steve Reeves about how he would not add more muscle mass because it would ruin the structure of his body. That was really amazing. And Bob Parris pretty much did follow that advice. And he refused to get bigger, and he never won a professional title and really didn't even never place that high. So he did not fulfill the promise that people were hoping for, but he did it because he refused to bow to the judges' wishes, and he decided to keep the physique that he wanted to keep. So that was interesting. So amazing articles. I hope you guys enjoyed them. We will be back next week with either a guest or some more articles. So I hope you enjoyed this one. Again, if you guys have any questions or comments for me, just shoot them over to naturalolympia@gmail.com. Until then, train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.